big time card coming up from the UFC's Apex main event. Sean Strickland defending that middleweight glory in the top 15, taking on Abusmagomedov. Some big time fights this weekend. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks. And the fights this weekend on July 1st. So in honor of that, Matt, it's Canada Day. My face is red, your face is white, and we're getting set for a big time card.
I finally put on sunscreen for once and it worked.
As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And when we look at the card that's coming up this weekend, 12 total fights, you have the 7th ranked middleweight in the main event. It is Sean Strickland going into his 5th UFC main event, his 18th overall contest, and he's taking on a somewhat unproven Abusmagomedov. And this type of stuff doesn't happen very often. Since 2016, September 2016 to be specific, only 3 fighters have fought in their second fight being a main event. Chris Cyborg, you also had Yuri Prohoshka and Michael Chandler, and all of a sudden Abusmagomedov getting a little bit of that rub. And don't forget, Cyborg became a champ, Prohoshka became a champ, and in Michael Chandler's second UFC fight, a title opportunity against Charles Oliveira. So big things to come for Abusmagomedov. I mean, you look at that record coming into his 31st pro fight, a PFL finalist. You also had one last weekend in Loic Radjabov. PFL, a little bit off the wheels last week. But when we look at this card overall, some debuts to look forward to, 7 total ranked opponents on this card. So a lot to get excited about, and probably a quick one on a Saturday.
It's a fun card because I think upon initial review, you might be down on it, right? You've got a Sean Strickland main event against a guy you don't know a lot about, but once you do the deep dive into the card, there's a lot of really competitive matchups that I know personally I'm really excited for. And like you said, these opportunities don't come around very often where you can kind of go from zero to hero overnight. And if Magomedov is able to go out there, let's say he finishes Sean Strickland, right? Like the craziness happens, Strickland goes out there, puts on a great performance, but he's not able to get it done. Magomedov does become a star overnight, right? Because Sean Strickland is only in these fight night main events and on huge fight cards. So I think Magomedov could pick up a lot of that steam if he is able to get the win. But for Strickland, it's kind of surprising to see a fighter in his position in the division take on such a big challenge like this.
13-5 already in the UFC is Sean Strickland. For Abusmagomedov, less than a minute to dispatch Dustin Stoicevus in his UFC debut. You look at this overall, Ivana Petrovic, the former Ares FC flyweight champ, she's making her UFC debut. You also have a short notice call-up, and it is Nursultan Ruziboyev. He's going to be taking on one Bruno Ferreira, and if you do consider it, one other short notice debut on about 10 days notice for Upstate Karate Zone, Weston Wilson. And listen, Stephen Wonderboy Thompson seems like he's coaching Conor McGregor's team, so all of a sudden, one of Wonderboy's guys, Weston Wilson, making that UFC debut. We also have, and you guys were all over our Twitter page, at Fight Night Picks today, the long-awaited return, a guy that's main evented multiple UFC shows. It's the Motown Phenom, Kevin Lee. He's going to be taking on the former GFC middleweight champ. It's Rinat Fakhretdinov.
Great fight.
I know you folks are excited about that. So 12 total fights. The show, it is ? That's going to kick off 2 hours before the prelims. We're going to be partying. I mean, it's a Saturday. It is Canada Day on Saturday. Looking forward to that one on July 1st. Some big time fights coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. So it's come to this. Yet again, another start me up. We have the Georgian Viking, Guron Khtataladze, representing Sweden and Georgia. Became a Swedish citizen in 2019. He's set to welcome in on short notice Brazil's Elvis Brenner. And when I looked at this fight, and I threw a tweet out there as soon as I saw it was announced, I said, from 50,000 feet, this fight seems really silly.
It does.
But then I went back and I did the deep dive, and my brain played a little bit of a trick on me, because for Guron Khtataladze, for me, for you, for everybody that's out there, we all kind of consider this guy the 16th lightweight,
exactly.
But we just don't get to see him fight. He's had a knee injury, he's had a rib injury, he's had visa issues. Not only plagued his fight that he was supposed to have a month ago against Jamie Mullerkey, but it's been a constant issue for him. So hopefully we get Guron competing in Vegas this weekend. But it's kind of a short notice throw together type of fight, because Elvis Brenner was originally due one Jordan Levitt. Levitt out of the fight, Guron accepts it, and now all of a sudden we're in a strange position. If you consider it for Brenner, he made his UFC debut earlier on this year down in Australia as a giant underdog against Zubair Takugov. And Brenner came into that one. Was he a featherweight? Was he a lightweight? We don't really know. And then all of a sudden, you ultimately have one Zubair Takugov missing weight. So in that fight, it takes place. At the end of it, I'm all in a tizzy. I threw it out there on Twitter. I didn't understand the scoring one bit. And now my brain is in a blender. It's in a pretzel. It's wherever you want to put it. But going back and watching the tape on both of these guys and really considering all avenues, I think this is a closer fight than just on the initial inspection.
This is what I like about the fight. Brenner's going to take the fight to Kukatoladze, and I think that's always going to be the key. Because if Guram's allowed the space to just operate on his own range, he's a pretty difficult guy to beat, right? He does have that one-of-one athleticism where he has good power. He has really fast strikes, too. And that really has been the key. Go back and watch the Gamrot fight. You see the speed with which he's able to counter not only the wrestling, but the strikes of Gamrot as well. And I've always thought that, hey, Kukatoladze, you bring it up. It's always been a, hey, oh, by the way, with him, because if you just talk about the skill set, there's really not a lot to critique. He has great takedown defense, he has good offensive takedowns too, and he does have great physical strength. It's not really something that you can gauge. It's very difficult to just go out there and say, but if you go back and watch any of his fights, he can muscle his way out of very difficult positions. But the thing that I love about this matchup is Brenner, and we saw this a lot in the Takugov fight, he likes to work at not a long range, but a long middle range. He's kind of specific with where he is. He likes the front kicks up the middle, and he does have a very good jab too, and I think those two weapons are going to be really key in this matchup against Kukatoladze, because Guram does like to plant his feet and then set up for the roundhouse kick and really emphasize power on his strikes more. If Brenner can get into the range where he does find success, and if he can break up some of that timing of Guram, I think he can make it a really interesting fight. But at that point, that's when Guram can close the distance, start to use some of that strength, use the clinch work, and that's where the fight is going to be really interesting. I just think for Brenner, the activity is really going to be the key for him, especially on the feet, because I don't think he can go one for one in power shots with Guram.
And for Guram, you might as well stick with Guram, because it's not a cuckoo clock, it's a Kukatoladze clock. So if you do consider it and you look at it, I mean, Kukatoladze trains out of one of those gyms that's going to get you ready for a fight like this. Exactly. And it's not just his own gym being House of Samurai over there in Sweden. It's also All-Stars. We have two All-Stars fighters on this card. Ivana Petrovic, who's going to be making her UFC debut, taking on Dread Luana Carolina. But Guram, mainly out of that gym, you knew him as the friend of Khamzat Chimaev before he made the UFC. But you've seen it out of Guram, the fights that he had with Brave, the knockout win over Felipe Silva, UFC debut. That was kind of wild. But if you compare the gyms for a second, was Elvis Brenner in the infamous sauna picture with the Shoot the Box boys? You're f***ing right he was. You know he's a ride or die. So for Elvis Brenner, he's one of those guys that I had very low expectations on him coming into the UFC. I mean, if you looked at it, Zubair Takugov was a minus 560 favorite when the fight started against Brenner. Going into the third round, they showed those live odds, minus 750. I went back and watched that fight with the sound off, and that was the first fight, obviously, I watched to get ready for any of these videos today. And boy, did the commentary mess with my mind, because they kept showing the stats, they kept emphasizing how good Takugov was at hitting the head, but they de-emphasized the fact that Brenner was going to the body, that he was going to the legs with the kicks, and after a while, he had that hairline cut for Takugov that definitely played into it, but he was limp and kind of lame on his front leg, and it really caused some issues. Now, Brenner, you saw the combinations. He'd go thudding kick, and then he'd go to the left hook with to the body. The trouble that Brenner has, though, is he tends to drop his hands a little bit, and as he drops his hands, it opens up the right shot from his opponents. And for a guy like Guram, a nice right cross, you saw that big overhand left that isn't really a big strike that's accentuated for Orthodox fighters, but he was able to throw it when he was fighting Mateusz Gamrot. It's just one of those fights where Brenner could get ahead with some of those overall numbers. It's just at the end of it, they might say, well, all the strikes to the head, they go to Guram. Guram wins the fight. I was very, very impressed by Brenner from age 20, where he came in fighting less than stellar competition down in Brazil, to fighting Gabriel Santos, who ended up as an LFA champ, and then he ended up getting finished by David Onama last weekend. All that to say, though, from watching Brenner's tape and getting ready for the Takugov fight, where I was really low on Brenner, I've seen marked improvements in every single fight where he has gotten better. He has really honed in his striking, and Brenner's one of those unique fighters to where he is a Muay Thai fighter. Majority of his wins are by submission, and you see the bread get buttered when he does get it down to the mat, too.
Exactly, and that is the nice thing about him. He's not somebody who is so one-note like some other fighters on this card. We're going to talk about people who really only have one aspect to their game. But for Brenner, that is the nice thing, like you said. He can hurt you on the feet, get the submission after he does go to the ground. I think he is going to struggle, though, with the physical strength of a guy like Guram, because you bring it up, Brenner's not a big guy for this division, at least against some of the more elite fighters.
He is Guram, tall, and he does have nice reach, but
I wouldn't say he's not a filled-in fiter. And for Guram, he's a lengthy, rangy guy. He's a muscular fighter, too, and I think it is a difficult weight cut for him to get down to 155, so you have to assume, hey, that might compromise him on the back end, but I've never seen his cardio completely fail him, at least in the UFC, and these are high-activity fights that he's been involved in the Usmagulov fight, and in the Mateusz Gamrot fight previous to that. I agree with everything you say about Brenner and all of the noticed improvements that he has made fight in and fight out, but it's a big step up, I believe, to take on a guy like Guram at the end of the day.
And Elvis Brenner, when he fought against Juan Zubair Takigov, Brenner was the 41st ranked lightweight in Brazil on Tapology. And there's a lot of them, but still not up to snuff whatsoever. If you click on their individual pages, it's 106 versus the 20th lightweight in the world. So Brenner, another giant step up. Yeah. But again, he does get better and better. His takedowns are a little unorthodox. You're not going to see freestyle takedowns, double leg, single leg. It's a lot of body lock, trip throws. It's
if
a lot Cameron of body leg takedowns.
If Gamrot can't have a lot of success doing it, I think Brenner will do.
We'll see how it goes out there, but a lot of fun when you do look at a matchup like this. And for me, I look at a guy like Brenner. He does traditionally fight from the orthodox stance, and he uses a lot of boxing combinations there. When he goes to southpaw, it's like Charles Jourdain. We're shelling up big time, and he does get hit by a lot of hooks, just like Jourdain. But he loves to go with that body kick from southpaw.
I think he just throws more kicks with the left side, though. Because even when he's orthodox, he throws that lead leg quite a bit. Like, he'll throw it as a leg kick. He'll throw it as a lead kick. It's just a lot of his kicks come from that left leg.
Yeah, a lot of body kicks from the southpaw. A lot of head kicks as well. You look at the odds in the matchup. Kutata Ladze is heavily favored in this fight. We'll have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you, Matt. I'm going to say over under. I think the fans are wild, and they're not big Brenner fans, so I'm going to say over under 90% for the Georgian Viking in this one.
I'll defend the fans a little bit. Even if you're not a big Brenner fan, it is difficult to just look there and think, okay, you have one vote. It's for Guram, or it's for Brenner. The majority of fans are probably going to go with Guram. I'm going to say it's above
90. It is above 90, so 699 total votes. 96 for Guram Kutataladze, 59% by decision, 33% by knockout. And again, going back and watching that Brenner fight, I scored the first round. I said it was close. I thought Brenner got the first round. Second round, Takigov. Third round was close. I thought Takigov did enough, but the scorecards, they were all over the place. There was 130-27 for Brenner in and amongst that. I do like Kutataladze in the matchup, and I think the fact that he can dig that hook to the body, Brenner's one of those guys, as I said, he shells up a lot like a Charles Jourdain, where Charles will do something different. He'll crouch a little bit when he wants to kind of dig it to the body. You saw that against Shane Burgos in that fight. If he's trying to defend some of those body strikes, Brenner still keeps a high tie stance, and he doesn't necessarily defend the body shots. That opens up the shots of a guy like Guram Kutataladze to the body. And for Guram, in the fight against Usmagulov, in the fight that he had against Gamrot, it was 12 and 28 body shots total. 34.7% of his overall strikes went to the body against those two opponents who were top 15 guys. Spider-Man meme, seeing as Magulov also on this card. But for me, I like the body work out of Guram, and I think the fact that he throws a nice right cross, a nice left hook, and he complements his kicks in all of that package, I like Guram in the fight.
I like Guram in this fight too, but I'm going to just admit something about myself. I thought he lost his debut and won his other fight. Like, I have predicted, not even predicted, but I thought he lost to Gamrot. I know he did good with his own wrestling, and he did well with his own knockdown strikes as well. But he did get controlled quite a bit in that matchup. And against Usmagulov, I thought he looked really good. And like you mentioned, those are two extremely talented fighters. Like, Usmagulov isn't the co-main event because he's some random guy at lightweight. I do have Guram, but this is an important fight because, again, all those oh by the ways can get erased with a really nice performance.
We'll see how it goes for Kutataladze. We saw a fighter get ready for fight after fight after fight and lose last weekend against a debuting fighter. That was Zalgiris Usmagulov against a very game Joshua Van. So both of us in this matchup going with the Georgian Viking to get the win. Let us know who you have in the matchup and some big time fights as we continue down through UFC Vegas 76. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. couple of lower ranked heavyweights going at it coming up this weekend. It's a win, you're in, you lose, you go home. Matt, we have King Kong Alexander Romanov. He's going to be taking on Baga Blagoy Ivanov. And I feel like for a guy like Blagoy Ivanov, and through the last two or three fights that he's had in the UFC, it's like he just felt bad that Gordon Lightfoot had passed away. And the only song he has on his iPod, because you know he has an iPod, and not even an iPod Touch.
The shuffle.
We're getting the play button. It's Carefree Highway by Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh,
because
sad,
if
man.
You watch Blagoy Ivanov from the Bellator days, where he had lost to Alexander Volkov, who's probably going to be creeping around this week. We've seen him at the PI training with Rinat Fakhretdinov as well as Demir Ismagulov. I'm sure he's around. If you look at it for Ivanov, fights Volkov back with Bellator, doesn't get it done there. Ivanov then goes on to World Series, becomes a heavyweight champ there. He has that one-off fight in the PFL where he's still the champion. And then Blagoy Ivanov does something that rarely ever happens unless you're, I don't know, Justin Gaethje. Blagoy Ivanov, UFC debut, main event against Junior Dos Santos. And Ivanov doesn't win that fight. But what we've seen out of Ivanov in the UFC is not necessarily a propensity to grapple, which we were used to. I mean, a combat sambo world champ back in 2008. Split a couple of matches against Fedor Emelianenko. Ever heard of him? But if you've watched Blagoy Ivanov, it's a lot of low volume, lay, pray, as you stand. And he's one of those guys, we saw it last weekend, the old snap city late in a fight, trying to tire down a fighter. Blagoy Ivanov does that like the best of them. You saw that in his fight against Augusto Sakai, which he somewhat controversially did lose. And Sakai grabbed the fence on that last takedown attempt. What I've seen out of Ivanov, I mean, there have been a couple of flashes. You saw that short shot that he took against Tai Tuivasa that dropped him. You saw in the second round the phantom tap in that one by Tuivasa, but they didn't call it. Ivanov ends up getting the win there, and that's probably, I would say, his best win that he has so far in the UFC.
And that's the weird thing, because you mentioned he debuted against JDS. You would assume he has a bunch of big wins by now. But for Ivanov, he's a great defensive fighter. He will get hit by some shots, but that's kind of the unfortunate thing to say about
him. That gets people going on Saturdays.
And that's my big problem with this card, why I was smiling during the intro for this fight. I think the opening fight to this fight card is going to be really fun, right? That's a fight you want to show your friends who don't know a lot about the sport. The problem is this fight comes after it. So you've got to find a 20-minute window to go do a fun activity to get them away from the TV so that their overall just impressions of the sport aren't ruined. Because there is a world out there where these two guys do have a lot of clinch work. Romanov goes for a lot of those high-amplitude takedowns, those high-frequency takedowns that he enjoys. Doesn't get any of them. And then we just have Blagoy Ivanov, who he is really heavy on top. He does have very good technique, though, with his overhooks and underhooks. I know people make fun of Dominic Cruz for talking about those, and I know it does get tired after a long time, but that's the good thing about Blagoy Ivanov. He has great fundamentals in a lot of those areas, and that's why he wins out in a lot of those spots. Think about Holly Holm at this stage of her career, right? I know we talk about a lot about the kickboxing and the striking, but how does she win a lot of these fights? It's a lot of very intelligent cage control and very high MMA IQ moves, and that's why this fight's so difficult to predict. Romanov can go in there and throw Ivanov one time, and I know that's a very high, I guess, risk strategy to go for, but he has the strength to do it. He has the ability to do it. The problem is, if he doesn't get the first, if he doesn't get the second, what version of Romanov are we going to get as this fight continues?
Yeah, he looked absolutely terrible against Alexander Volkov his last time out. And for Romanov, he lost to Volkov. He got finished in that fight, just like Blagoy Ivanov did. But if you consider it for a guy like Romanov, he tries those first few.
But that was a weird fight for Romanov. Coming off a loss, they were like, hey, you want to fight Alexander Volkov next?
Yeah, and it really was an odd fight. And again, you had Romanov coming off of a loss where it was to Marcin Tybura, and it was a fight where Romanov dominated the action in the first round. Pretty surprising that they didn't score at a 10-8. I mean, you did end up having one of them, so a majority decision win for Tybura. Second round, third round, Alexander Romanov is quite tired. The only fight that we've seen Romanov fight with a weird cardio was his fight against my guy, the Canary Islands' own Senegalese wrestling champ. It's Juan Espino. And in that fight, Espino wins the first round, Romanov wins the second round, but he also had a magnet in his cup. And in the third round, he gets hit below the belt. It goes to a technical decision. Romanov ends up winning two of those rounds. But if you watch the first round against Juan Espino, it's full power coming off the Ultimate Fighter, Juan Espino, after a long time away. But you know how good Espino is.
He took a bit of a detour after the Ultimate Fighter.
In wrestling. And Romanov pressures the action up against the fence. And then with his back to the cage, it's like a judo toss throw from Juan Espino. And Espino's on top for large portions of that first round. So for Romanov, all the big actions don't necessarily equate to all the big wins. And we kind of give a similarity or comparison between Romanov and a guy out of the Romania area, and that's Nicolae Negu-Mehreanu, because if you want to keep your videos monetized, you got to watch out pronouncing that guy's last name. For Romanov, a lot of high amplitude takedowns, but it wears on him. And if you look at Romanov in the UFC, minus 380, minus 500, minus 140, minus 525, minus 2200, minus 330, and minus 145. He's been a favorite, and even a giant favorite. Now, that was against a short notice Shea Sherman in all of his UFC
fights. I think that's because when we see it all go right for Romanov, it does look great. He gets, like, a belly-to-belly suplex like he's Kurt Angle, gets on top of his opponent, lands hellacious ground and pound. Like, it's a fun style to watch.
Yeah, it's more like a Vitaly Minnikov at the peak of his powers with Bellator.
I think more people know who Kurt Angle probably is, so I'm just going to stick with that one. But for Romanov, again, when everything breaks right, it is so fun to watch, and it is such a fun prospect to have in the heavyweight division. But I bring it up in our last matchup. There's some fighters on this card who are quite one-dimensional, and Alexander Romanov is that fighter. If he gets into the mat, we see him dominate a lot of fighters, especially from that top position. He's oddly fast when he is able to kind of get on all four limbs. He can pass guard. He does have a lot of those strengths in his game, but the problem is when he doesn't get the game, or when he doesn't get the fight to where he wants it, what else is there in his game that can go out there and win a lot of rounds? There's just not a ton.
That's it for Romanov. 10 of 16 wins are by submission in ways such as arm triangle, neck crank, three forearm chokes, one against Marco Sugero de Lima in the UFC, rear naked choke, as well as the old key lock. Get him out there. Steve Mowry likes that key lock at heavyweight with Bellator MMA. Matt, when you look at it in a matchup like this, I mean, it is also southpaw versus southpaw. And if a knife to the heart couldn't kill Blagojevanov and made him look like a 50-something, 20-something, then I don't know what
it aged him horribly.
If you look at this matchup, Matt, I mean, it's crazy that the doctors walked him out of that hospital to take pictures after he gets stabbed.
It's crazy this is the second fight on the card where normally this would be the co-main event. So let's just be happy with the card placement.
I'm cool that Romanov is a slight favorite. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us, Eric. I know all the commenters under the full card video are going to say Blagoy is going to outlast Alexander Romanov. So I think that the votes are going to be somewhat close. So I'm going to say over under 70% Romanov. And that's close to me.
So I'll do this a little reverse. I have Ivanov. I do think he's going to win this fight. I don't think the Tapology voters are going to give him that respect. I do think Romanov will still be the favorite.
All right. Oh my goodness. Look at that. 754 total votes. 68% Romanov. So it was pretty close. But they all see it going decision. 63% decision.
And that's what I disagree with.
Romanov and 79% decision by Ivanov. And I think Romanov goes out there and does beat Blagoy Ivanov. And the reason why is, I mean, yeah, Blagoy did look good against Tai Tuivasa in that matchup that was back in 2019. He looked a step slow against Derek Lewis, even though he was able to go out there and get some of the takedowns. Against Augusto Sakai, it was a back and forth fight. That was over 3 years ago. Against Marco Sugero de Lima, it was like somebody was playing around with an old time watch, just going real slow with the time right there. And then against Marcin Tybura, Tybura controlled large portions of the action. Blagoy just hasn't really looked like himself as he's aged. And I think from the southpaw stance, it's going to open up some of those kicks from Alexander Romanov. The last reason why I like Romanov in this fight, he's trained for certain fights a while ago in Vegas to get acclimatized with his comrade team. Now, this one, he's been back home training at Lion Comrade. Before he fought Marcin Tybura, he was over in Thailand training with Anatoly Malyakin, Arjun Singh Buller. Yikes, he was able to get the win there. That was last weekend. And getting ready for the fight that he had his last time out against Volkov, he was competing in a lot of grappling tournaments, was Alexander Romanov. But for this one, it seems like it's been a lot of wrestling to get him ready for a guy like Ivanov. Ivanov does have some decent takedown defense in the UFC, although we've seen De Lima, Tybura, and Derek Lewis test it a little bit. I just think that Romanov is going to be able to get it done, and I don't see Blagoy popping right back up.
I think this fight's not going to be very good. I think it's going to be a low-volume affair where both guys go for their takedown attempts, and that's why I do have Ivanov in it. I just think he's going to win more of those stale moments between their fighters. That's why I bring up the Holly Holm comparison. Holly Holm's fights aren't fight of the nights right now, right? She goes out there, though, and she wins all of those quote-unquote boring moments. She's able to win them all because she's the one pressuring her opponent up against the cage. She's doing things that judges value, and I do think Blagoy Ivanov, you hate to predict a fight going that way. He does things that judges value outside of damage. damage and, like, finishing fights. But I do have Blagoy Ivanov in this match.
All right, Matt. Split on the pick. Matt going with Bulgarius. Blagoy Ivanov going with the man out of Romania. It's actually Moldova. We have Alexander Romanov. Matt, some big-time fights on this card, including Joanderson Brito, who's going to be taking on Weston Wilson. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And it's finally time, the UFC debut for the Aris FC flyweight champ. It's Ivana Petrovic. She's going to be taking on Luana Carolina Dredd. Matt, when you look at a matchup like this for Ivana Petrovic, I mean, I don't have enough room in the country box to give her enough opportunity. I mean, Bosnia-Herzegovina, you also have Croatia represented as well as Norway. And if you look at it for Petrovic and you're trying to find some of the fight tape that's out there, it's either Ivana Petrovic or Ivana Siric. Petrovic, like, there is a couple of different names out there. But what I can tell you is, for Petrovic, I mean, 5 of her 6 overall wins as a pro are by finish. If you do look at it, an amateur to the nth degree. She had a really tidy record over there. A couple of really, really big wins over there. I mean, one over Melissa Dixon, who was supposed to be fighting for the bantamweight belt with Aris not that long ago. Dixon missing weight. She also has that win her last time out against Wozniak that definitely ages very, very exactly. Well. And going back and watching the Petrovic tape, I mean, there's a lot to like out of her and her opponents in some of her fights. So I was a little bit surprised looking at the record, having really high hopes, watching the fight tape, and then ending up where I am right now. But you want to give everybody their shine. She's going to be taking on Luana Carolina, who came in off the big-time Dana White's Contender Series season that was Brazil. And it happened once, but it produced stars like Johnny Walker, Marina Rodriguez, Dredd Carolina, and coming into the UFC, she was highly touted. Sao Paulo State Muay Thai champ twice over. A Brazilian national Muay Thai champ twice over. And for Carolina, that head kick that she landed against Priscilla Cachoeira, that was wild in their fight. Carolina looked great in that one. But now, it's a 50-50 UFC record. She has been able to go out there and beat some blueprint fighters similar to Ivana Petrovic, namely Lupe Godinez, even though Godinez had fought a week before and moved up a weight class to take that fight. But for Carolina, her last time out, she took on the forever ranked, but not ranked in that fight, Joanne Wood. And in that matchup, I think I was the only one at the time that thought that Carolina had won the matchup. But if you do look at it, Carolina got out-volumed in some of the striking. And
she still threw good volume, I'd say.
She did. Carolina excels moving backwards, which doesn't happen very often. She throws really good boxing combinations and mixes in those kicks to all three levels from that tricky sidewinder southpaw stance. But where Carolina usually beats the majority of her opponents in the clinch, she wasn't able to do it against Wood. So a big reset for Carolina, who's lost her last 2 fights, 2-3 in the 5-1 in for Petrovic, obviously 5-0. But Matt, lots of things that I like out of both of these women, and I could be a little negative on some of the deficiencies, but I think it's going to be a really fun matchup and a great learning experience for somebody like Petrovic here.
I feel like I've had an awful read on Carolina throughout her whole entire UFC career, and it's because the highs have been quite high. And if you do showcase primarily her striking, it is quite crisp. It is very compact. Like you say, she does strive at doing something that not a lot of people can do. It's like what people say about D'Angelo Russell. He's great at doing all the hard things at basketball, but he's not really good at doing the easy things. And for Carolina, she can throw kicks moving backwards. She can throw in combination moving backwards. But why allow your opponent to lead the dance and dictate what terms the fight takes place under? And I know for Carolina, her movement is able to, or it does allow her to evade some takedown attempts, right? We talked about that. You can't just rely on good takedown defense, be it from underhooks or just your own wrestling. You do have to be able to evade some of those techniques with your own footwork, and I do think Carolina is able to do that. But the problem is, and that's my big issue with her in this matchup, we saw her get out volume by a Joanne Wood, who is at more of an advanced stage of her career. And in that fight, if you thought Carolina was going to win in any way, it was probably going to be damaging Wood on the back foot, really making her pay for some of those half-hearted takedown attempts we've seen throughout the career of Wood. But Carolina really wasn't able to do a lot of that.
No, and that was it for Carolina. You go down through some of the wins, some of the losses. You look at the fight against Lupe Godinez. Godinez wins the first round. Carolina rallies, ends up winning the fight. You go back to her fight that she had against McCann. She loses the first round, and then Carolina wins round 2. She's winning round 3, and then she gets knocked out. You go back and you look at the fight against Pollyanna Battaglio. She loses the first round, gets 10-8'd pretty well, and then rallies round 2, round 3. So Carolina, the takedown defense, it's kind of wishy-washy. And for Ivana Petrovic, I listened to an interview that she had done with Chaos MMA, Ryan Perlmutter. Ryan Perlmutter. And Petrovic already in Vegas getting ready for this matchup. She also has great English, so really good skills there. She said that she got the UFC call a week or two after her recent Aris Title FC fight that she had against Wozniak. She was ready for it. She kind of left vacation early to start getting ready for this matchup. She likes the fact that her wrestling and her jiu-jitsu should carry her to a win in this matchup. Said that her teammates think that she's going to get the second round submission win in it. And yeah, it very well could happen. You look at it for Petrovic, you look and you consider, well, 6-0 as a pro, what's the combined opponent record? It's 14-5. So it is what it is. A lot of inexperience, but exactly. Some good wins along the way. Again, I said the Dixon fight as an amateur. That's a pretty darn good one because Dixon's had a good pro career. Another good one against Chanel Dyer as well. But probably the best fighter that she has faced was her last time out against Wozniak for the belt. And in that one, pre-fight, Matt, I went back and I watched the stare down. And they mean mugged it. You had a push from Petrovic, who said in the interview that she did that, listen, the Wozniak kind of initiated it, but I've never seen somebody look more perplexed than Siddle Gahn standing in the background of that one. So you look at it for somebody like Petrovic, and in that fight that she had against Wozniak, you watch it, and you say, okay, well, in that, it was the biggest cage I've ever seen. And Wozniak was really able to control large portions of that fight. And that's the trouble that I have watching these Petrovic fights, going back and watching all of the fights, because they're pretty easy to find. She struggles a lot in the striking, but she herself gets backed up a lot in these exchanges. And she tends to box, but she drops her hands and doesn't move her head. She also backs up on the center line with her hands down with no pullback on that. And she will throw kicks. She is a tricky southpaw in her own right. So we have a fight before this. Romanov taking on Ivanov, southpaw, southpaw. Karolina Petrovic, southpaw, southpaw. So it's going to accentuate the kicks for somebody. But if you look at it for Petrovic, she likes to plant her feet and then try and land her shots. And when she does, she can kind of lead with her head and leave it down. She gets hit a lot, and Wozniak was able to land big shots on her. Before that, her fight that she had against one Tekana, she's taken on a 2-0 fighter where she had success with the takedowns, but she struggled in the striking. I've also seen Petrovic really struggle in her fight against Walaszczyk, where she wins a split decision, but the commentary team thinks that Walaszczyk won all three rounds in that one. Petrovic gets rocked by the hands, gets rocked by the kick, gets dropped by a knee. Petrovic, I mean, for as good as she can be on the mat, she can get taken down in these fights, but she has decent enough abilities to get the feet back on the hips, to really try and go for a Kimura or an arm lock to get herself back up or into position. She is good with the scrambles, and Petrovic trains at really good gyms to get ready for this. Orion MMA is one of them. You also have Frontline Academy with Jack Hermanson, the Nordic fighters. Marathon Hamlet, who's going to be taking on Impact Sanganai with PFL, as well as Kenneth Berg, who always looks scary but can never fight in the UFC with all his tattoos. But Petrovic, again, All-Stars, Orion, and Frontline, a lot of great gym and a lot of great women that train at those gym to get you ready for a fight like this. But seeing the undefeated record, seeing all the finishes, I was surprised on the tape study because I was underwhelmed with what I saw coming into this one.
That can be true, but Luana Carolina is an 8-4 fighter. And yes, her strengths are very impressive for what they are, but you bring it up. There are some weaknesses in her game as well. And that's why this is a pretty good debut, right? Like, this isn't Petrovic fighting who? Amanda Hibas. It's not her fighting. Like, a lot of good fighters in this division who have a lot of respect. That's why I do like this matchup for her in her introduction. And it really comes down to game plan, because if she has an effective game plan in the matchup, I think she can negate and disrupt a lot of the timing of Carolina with her strikes. And if she is able to get it down to the mat and neutralize some of that high volume of Carolina, I think the time spent on top is going to help keep those volume numbers down.
Yeah, that's just the trouble that I have with it. Again, she took on a 34-year-old 5-4 Marta Walaszczyk not that long ago in under 2 years, and she nearly got finished in that fight on multiple occasions. So you look at the odds in the matchup, Petrovic is a pretty darn big favorite, representing again Bosnia-Herzegovina, Norway, and Croatia. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 87.5% for Petrovic here.
I feel like that's high. I'll say under.
You're going to say under. It is over. 756 total votes, 92% Petrovic, 41% by decision, 48% by submission. For the 8% that of Carolina, 77% by decision. Matt, Do I do the old switcheroo with my pick here after I've done a whole video talking about how I don't necessarily like Petrovic in the matchup? Do you think?
So if you don't like her in the matchup, that means you're going to pick Karolina?
No, what's your pick here?
I think Petrovic, again, I just think her time spent on top is going to be effective enough. Karolina has great striking, but I don't know if the power that she possesses is going to be able to go out there and just stop Petrovic. Yes, the knockdown could happen, but unless she is able to get some of those really devastating strikes, I just think the takedown ability should be able to counteract whatever volume she gets.
I think regardless of the short notice ability of Lupita Godinez in her matchup with Luana Karolina, I think Karolina wins this fight because I've seen that happen. I've seen the Battaglio fight. I've seen good volumes numbers out of Luana Karolina, and I think she's a much better striker than anybody that Petrovic has fought, pro and amateur. So I do like Luana Karolina in this matchup for sure. Let us know who you have down below in the comment section on this one, because the votes on Tapology are wild so far. We have some big time fights left on this card, Matt. The next one, it is a big timer. You have Joanderson Brito taking on Weston Wilson. Not going to want to miss that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
This weekend's But Why fight coming up on 10 days notice, replacing one Hussein Ashgabov. Where is he, Matt? I don't know. We have Weston Wilson representing one upstate Karatean. Weston Wilson, one of those guys, if you watch him fight, it's kind of like Jerry West if you melted him. Like if he was a crayon and you melted him, because he trains primarily with Wonderboy Thompson, and he looks like a silhouette of Wonderboy Thompson if you turn the sliders down a little bit. But for Weston Wilson, you'll see it on the screens that'll go through. I mean, 16-7, 11 of his wins by submission. He strikes like an absolute wild man, like Joanderson Brito, but he loves to really try and land a kick and then off his kick, grab your leg and take you down to the mat.
And that, I'm so happy you bring it up this way, so let's just jump right into it. That's the weird thing about a guy like Weston Wilson. And first of all, his name belongs in like the Wild West with a big badge on and an old-timey mustache. Like, that's Weston Wilson's territory. You won't stay away from there. But he doesn't really fight like you'd assume when you just look at him standing in the middle of the cage. Because when you do see that silhouette of him, you do assume that it is going to be very footwork heavy, very kick heavy with a lot of that flash. But he is much more willing to invite that brawl than you would really assume.
I mean, if you woke up in the morning and your eyes aren't quite right and you're getting out of sleep and you see Weston Wilson, you go, is that Will Chope? Like, is that, because he's one of those guys, 6'1". I don't know how he makes featherweight. His last time out was a catchweight bout at 150 pounds. He beat an 8-5 fighter, and that's where I'm going to end up going with the video. But when I first heard that this matchup was announced, and it was announced by an organization that, quite frankly, I might not have necessarily heard of, but if you do look at this one, I mean, I saw Sean Bitter send the tweet out there, and he was so down on this one, and then that sent me into a spiral of a rabbit hole, because Sean Bitter is the prospect whisperer, and if he says that Weston Wilson might not be that guy, I go, okay, well, how is he not that guy? So I looked at Wilson's record, and I added it up. Now, again, records are for DJs, but number on a page, combined opponent record for Weston Wilson, he's 16-7, it's 132, 145-3. Of his wins, the combined opponent record is 72-99. Of his losses, 60-46-3. Weston Wilson has not beaten very good fighters, and names on a page, there's not names that have fought in big organizations that he's beaten.
And that's been the thing about Wilson. When you do look at a lot of the fight tape, I think there are a lot of positives that you can take away from it. I know initially I was really impressed by his ability to take the back of his opponents. He's really good once he is able to get it into some more of those scramble-based positions, because yes, he can get held down by sort of superior grapplers. He can get out-wrestled sometimes. And that's the thing about Wilson. He can get out-muscled sometimes because his offensive submissions are great. He can kind of get that Spider-Man type thing where he'll wrap up his opponent and threaten with a lot of different positions. But on the flip side, if he gets held down, it's really difficult for him to start sweeping his opponent off his back. He really does need that top position, and that's where I think this fight against Brito is going to be so insane, because if Brito stands in the inside and throws bombs, well, we know how powerful Joanderson Brito is. Like, this guy has absurd power, but he is great with his own submissions. He can go for scrambles, and he's somebody who, I will say this, I think Joanderson Brito is a more skilled fighter than Weston Wilson. He could probably beat guys who are higher up in the division than Weston Wilson can, but he also fights in an erratic manner that leaves the window, maybe the window is only a centimeter open right now, but the way that Joanderson Brito likes to fight leaves that window maybe two times open, wow. three times open, because he can get a little ahead of himself. He does wing power shots. He's not this great technician on the inside. And I think for those reasons, Weston Wilson could land one of those awkward power shots because he is a guy who's comfortable in the pocket.
Yeah, Weston Wilson's last three wins over 9-19, Marcus Andrusia. Mike Wilson, who was 4-3, was able to hit and take down Weston Wilson. And Fabricio Franco was 8-5. And if you go back and you watch the last fight that Wilson had with Tough Enough, I thought Macho Man Randy Savage, are you alive? Is that Bonesaw? No, it was Don Fry commentating the fights. And if you go back and you watch Weston Wilson fight a long in the tooth, but not short on experience, Taruto Ishihara, or as Jessica Rose Clark calls him the entire time, Tarut. In that one, Wilson is trying to be like Modestus Bukauskas. He's striking on the outside. He's really landing on Ishihara, but following him, because Wilson doesn't really cut off the cage. And in that one, Ishihara decides, screw that, I'm going to stand in front of him, land a left hand, and Wilson falls like a sack of potatoes, and that's the end of the fight. So for Wilson, it has been the fact that when he's fought some better fighters, he's lost. When he's fought the lesser competition, he's won. And he reminds me of Brandon Jenkins, who made a UFC debut not that long ago. Carl Deaton, who ended up fighting in the UFC not that long ago against Joe Selecki. Guys that have had really extensive careers as pros on the regional scene in the UFC, and then they get a shot in the UFC in this one. Joanna Sabritu, to get back to it, I mean, he fought Chip A. Mariscal with the LFA. He gets that win. He fights on Contender Series against Diego Lopes and decides, let's poke him in the eye a couple of times. The eye poke ends it in the third round, and there hadn't been any strikes to that point. So a rare 10-10 third round, less a point. So ultimately, it is 29-28 across the board. Lopes getting that third round, but the round one, round two, Joe Anderson, Britu, excellent with the takedowns, but he goes buck wild for them. And we saw Britu on the regional scene against fighters like Wellington Prado, Andy Wasaki. Britu had to rally in those fights because it was the takedown abilities and the overall scrambles that showed that his opponents could get one up on him. Now, I know Britu, his last two times out, I mean, a performance bonus scrambled in there. He beats Andre Fili, he beats Lucas Alexander, both of those in the first round. It wouldn't surprise me if Joe Anderson Britu won this fight in the first round, because Weston Wilson, sidewinder, southpaw, karate stance, and I don't know if it's because Wonder Boy's coaching Conor McGregor's team in The Ultimate Fighter. Hey, you're going to stick around for this practice, right? As Conor's going to the door, and then he has to turn back around.
Polar opposite personalities.
Conor McGregor, do you really want to be a part of this show, or do you just want to go to games?
He doesn't want to enter USADA.
But when you look at a matchup like this, I mean, Britu is going to be heavily favored in the matchup. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 90% Britu here.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's 96% over with 75% taking him to win by knockout. So I do have Joe Anderson Britu in the fight. I think Weston Wilson's a fun fighter, but guys like Will Chope, guys like Cole Miller, they had places in the UFC. They were able to get finished. Will Chope, no, because he only had the one fight against Max Holloway. But yeah, Cole Miller is up there for submissions in the UFC. But I look at a guy like Weston Wilson, I could just see him getting cracked by Britu. And if you watch that Chepe Mariscal fight, getting ready for last weekend's fight, you know what Britu can do. Find your balls and drop you dead.
I have Britu in this fight. He's just in a different space in the division. Like, this is a difficult matchup for Weston Wilson. I will say this, though, because I brought it up earlier. I don't think he has a large margin to get this win, but Britu fights in such a wild way. It's like brawling with John Lineker, right? You're probably going to get knocked out. Probably. But the way he fights means that you're going to be able to land a counter shot every now and then. You can make it interesting. So if Wilson was able to land one of those little inside power shots on Britu that could completely change the complexion of this fight, I'm going to be the first person to tell you I could see it happen, but I still have Britu in the matchup.
Both of us going with Brazil's own, Shoot the Box's own, formerly of Atos BJJ, with Davi Ramos, Joe Anderson Britu to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in the matchup. Some big time fights on this card, including Yana Santos sticking on Carol Hossa. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a rare women's featherweight fight on Canada Day, and like a Canadian band, Saskatchewan's own, the Sheepdogs. Who's going to win this fight? I don't know. Matt, we have Yana Santos taking on Carol Hosen. Why do I say that, folks? It's because you probably think, Craig, well, you talked up Carol Santo or Carol Hosa every single video. You were excited when she was on the 4-fight win streak. She lost to Sarah McMahon. Is all hope lost? No, because I thought that Hosa was going to look really good when she took on Lena Landsberg. She got dropped in the first round of that fight. She landed an illegal knee in that fight. She still wins it, though. And then Hosa, her last time out against Norma Dumont, she loses in some of the exchanges because she gets held up against the cage, but when she's able to land, she was out striking Dumont to the tune of a big time knockdown in the third round. And when Dumont gets up, what is Hosa do? Grabs underhooks and holds Dumont up against the cage. So the reason why I don't know who's going to win this fight, and I really don't, even going back and watching the tape study, is because Hosa, for as good as her striking is, look at the fight that she had against Dumont, where she drops her underhooks and goes into the clinch where Dumont excels, or the fight that Hosa has where she's able to get the fight down to the ground against Melissa Gatto, who's on this fight card. There's a lot of Spider-Man memes on this card. But Carol Hosa, in that fight, gets it down to the ground and then gets caught in an armbar against Gatto, which ultimately gets Gatto into the UFC 3 years later. Gets signed off that win, but 3 years later. Carol Hosa is one of these fighters that I have a hard time with. And for Yana Santos, why do I think she could beat Carol Hosa? It's because, well, she throws kickboxing combinations because she will land the kick at the end of her boxing combinations. But she too, like you saw against Stoyarenko or the majority of Santos wins, she'll grapple or she'll hold the fight up against the fence and land strikes in the clinch. And we saw that cause issues for Santos against Irene Aldana, who recently fought for the title. But it's against the upper echelon fighters that Santos struggles with. So when you look at this one, rankings on the line, albeit they're at featherweight, now there's no champ in either division. Yeah. I don't know what this fight does for either fighter. I know it was thrown in together on short notice because originally it was Yana Santos against Macy Chasson. But if you look at this fight in a vacuum, it's a tricky one to try and break down.
There's a couple main talking points I want to get to. And the first one being, I think it being contested at 145 favors Yana Santos, at least slightly, because of the reasons you bring up. Santos is the more grapple-heavy out of the two. And if she is able to get on top of Hosa, I just don't know if that's a position Hosa's going to be able to get out of convincingly in a lot of spots. Because Santos isn't a one-note grappler. She will go from full guard into half guard. She will progress through situations and not just stay in that full guard position. And Hosa can be active off her back, but I do think against the grappler of Santos's level, it's just going to be a little bit more difficult for her to get back up to her feet. With that being said, though, Yana Santos gets a bloody nose the second she walks into the cage. Like, she does not eat damage well at this stage of her career, and even in fights where she wins, she does accept quite a bit of damage on the feet.
Oh, the Marion Renault fight.
Exactly, that being a shining example of it. So, I just think both these fighters have very specific ways they can get this job done, because if Hosa can make this primarily a boxing fight, Santos will throw kicks from the outside to kind of keep her opponent at bay, but I wouldn't say Santos is throwing big damaging shots from the outside with her kicks. There are a lot more volume accumulators. They're more range finders. I'm not saying she has bad striking, but her striking is more of the type of a Christophe Jocko and less like her husband, a Thiago Santos. So I think for Santos, she can have success on the outside with her volume numbers, but I think if Hosa can make it ugly, get on the inside, use her elbows if they do find themselves in the clinch, because that's the position Santos likes to go for a lot of her takedowns from. I think Hosa, it's odd, because it might get to the end of the fight where Santos completes 3 takedowns, she might throw 78 significant strikes, and Hosa might get 1 takedown, you know, just from like a weird clinch. She might only land 50 strikes, but the strikes that Hosa lands, I do think are going to be a lot more damaging than the one Santos is.
Yeah, and we've seen Carol Hosa in her fight against Lena Landsberg. It was Hosa outlanding Landsberg in terms of volume in the first round, landing really good shots, but again, it was a right cross that Landsberg landed that sat down Carol Hosa. So it has been weird so far. There is, again, the reason why I don't have the little asterisk next to the weigh-in for Hosa. She fought 3 months ago at Norma Dumont against Norma Dumont. At featherweight, it was announced by WMMA Rankings on Twitter on June 17th that Hosa would be taking this fight against Santos. So short notice out of PRBT for Hosa. Yana Santos still out of ATT. And it's kind of funny because in the office to break the fourth wall, there's a poster for UFC 239. And look at that, Thiago Santos staring us down.
Wow.
PFL's
that was
known.
A great poster.
That was a good poster. But you look at this fight, Matt. Hosa is favored in the matchup. Yana Santos, the underdog. You see it on the screen. 4-4, the UFC record for Santos. She's got that Justin Gaethje in her, UFC 222, just main eventing for the title against Chris Cyborg and taking her down in the first round. But you consider it...
What happened for the rest of that round?
She did not win that fight. Carol Hosa, 2-1 favorite. We have a look at the topology votes. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over 2/3 have Carol Hosa.
I'll say over.
All right. And it is over. 76% have Carol Hosa at a 628 total votes. 92% by decision for the 24% that have Santos, 86% by decision. And I like Carol Hosa with the volume numbers that she's able to have. You saw her fight against Laura Procopio at the time, now Laura Fritzen. Where has she been? But she got the win there in impressive fashion. We've seen her be able to land really good volume numbers in these fights. I like the takedown defense enough. Again, she was the meal ticket for Sarah McMahon to go to Bellator to beat Arlene Blenko, big win. But for me, I do like Carol Hosa here.
I've also got Hosa in the matchup. If Yana had the type of takedown Sarah McMahon did, then maybe I would favor her a little bit more.
You mean like Tanya Evinger type?
Well, it's just, for Santos, it is a lot more of the judo type throws, the takedowns from the clinch to where she'll go body and then try to go for the trips. Sarah McMahon was an Olympian. Like, you don't get better at wrestling than Sarah McMahon all that often. So I do think the style of takedowns with which Santos goes for is going to make them a little bit easier for Hosa to defend. And it's going to get her in that boxing range where Hosa can have a lot of success. So I agree with you. I have Carol Hosa.
You want to be the most uncomfortable you've ever been watching an MMA event? Go watch that post-fight interview that Tanya Evinger does with...
Laura Sanko.
It is something. Matt, in this matchup, both of us going with Brazil's short-notice replacement, Carol Hosa, to get the win at featherweight. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big-time fights on this card, including Sean Strickland taking on Abus Magomedov. In the main event, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Guess who's back? The Motown Phenom touches down once more in Las Vegas. Coming up this weekend, the former multiple-time main eventer with UFC, it's Kevin Lee. He's taking on the gladiator, Rinat Fakhretdinov, a man who's won 16 fights in a row, the former GFC middleweight champion. That's a big thing for Rinat Fakhretdinov. Lots of middleweight experience coming into the UFC. And for Kevin Lee, we know the story. Lightweight up to welterweight. And then it was kind of a rocky road there. Loses to Daniel Rodriguez, and he's out of the UFC. And Lee, there were a lot of weight miss struggles on the way through. He missed weight when he was taking on Charles Oliveira. And ultimately, he ends up in a super lightweight fight with Eagle FC, a multi-fight deal. There's going to be so much Kevin Lee. And although that fight that he had against Diego Sanchez has 1.4 million views on YouTube, Kevin Lee had an issue in the first round with his knee, and it was that left knee, and you saw that as the fight wore on. Now, Lee went out there on Instagram, and he said he didn't need surgery on it. He'd be back kind of later on last year, but ultimately, that fight against Sanchez was last spring, and we haven't seen him since, and Kevin Lee, where the weight miss issues were a struggle when he was with the UFC, the knee issues were a big struggle too, so a lot of injury problems for Kevin Lee, and that potential was never really realized. He did have that, interim lightweight title fight against Tony Ferguson at UFC 216, and if you want to go back and see an awesome fight, it's great that fight. One against Tony Ferguson, but Kevin Lee was known for big explosion into big strikes. He had good boxing.
You're going to love this.
Greg. Awesome kicks on the outside to go along with that Grand Valley State wrestling that he had in his back pocket. Kevin Lee, one of those guys that you had to watch out for. But then 11-7 to the end. He has that weird fight against Diego Sanchez, who was on the outs with the UFC as well. And now he takes on that kind of rising up-and-comer in Rinat Fakhretdinov.
Kevin Lee is Kristaps Porzingis. We talked about him on Question Mark Kicks, and it's a great example of another athlete in another sport who has followed a similar career trajectory. Because I was going to ask you, who's your favorite, like, one-time All-Star, two-time All-Star from any sport? You know, there's always those guys out there who, when they retire...
Delibar.
There you go. When they retire, are they going to be Hall of Famers? No. But if you were a fan of that team, you were probably a huge fan of that player, and they had a lot of lasting moments in your life. Kevin Lee was one of those fighters. He was pushed heavily by the UFC. He had that great main event with Michael Chiesa, where they promoted it in that summertime event.
Six main events Kevin Lee had.
But remember his fast rise to the top? He lost to Santos, your boy, way back in the day, and a lot of people thought that would have derailed his hype train, but to Kevin Lee's credit, he was able to rebuild himself, and Lee is an interesting wrestler, because a lot of people look at Kevin Lee, and they assume he fights in the style of an Usman or a Covington, but he really doesn't. His wrestling does set up his jiu-jitsu more than anything, and that's what makes Kevin Lee so special. He is a phenomenal wrestler, but he's a really good back taker too, and that's what makes him so dangerous. He is insanely physically strong, But here's the problem with Kevin Lee. He burns so hot when he grapples that you do worry about what's going to happen after. And I think a good example of that is the Rafael Dos Anjos fighting. I know Dos Anjos is kind of an all-time great fighter, but at that stage in his career, that's not prime RDA, right? He had been through a lot of main events. He had lost to a lot of the elite at 170.
He's looked good since then.
He has, but I don't think a lot of people look at Rafael Dos Anjos and look at him as the same fighter who fought during UFC 200.
Not after this weekend on Twitter, they don't.
And won the lightweight championship. My point is, that was a very winnable fight for Kevin Lee, and he looked very good until he didn't. And that's been the big issue with Kevin Lee. He has all the skills in the world, but if he uses them a little bit too much and he doesn't monitor his gas tank, how many times do we see Kevin Lee huff and puff for gas in that third round? It is concerning. Even in fights where he has won in the past, that third round is, hey, you win the first two, bank them, and then we'll see what happens. And I do think the Ally Quinta matchup the second time around that main event was the first one that really made people realize, okay, Kevin Lee might not be ready to fight for the title at 155. Now, to his credit, and you bring it up, this is a 170 matchup, and I think this is the division for Kevin Lee. The weight misses, the weight issues at 155, they were just too numerous for me to want to see him back down to that weight class, so hopefully we just see a better version of him. But I'm saying the same thing as I am with Chris Stubbs this season with the Celtics. Now, Chris Stubbs at least gave us a good sample size where he looked really good with Washington, so it gives you hope, but Kevin Lee has had a long time off, and you bring up the Diego Sanchez fight. He got outstruck in some of those moments against Diego Sanchez, and I know the knee was an issue. I'm not discrediting that whatsoever, but that's not promising to see. You know, Kevin Lee getting touched up by an older Sanchez.
Yeah, Kevin Lee, if you do consider it, I mean, I thought going back and watching his rematch against Ally Quinta, because Kevin Lee's first fight in the UFC was against Ally Quinta.
Exactly.
Ally Quinta won it. Lee was favored to beat Ally Quinta in the second fight, and from the first round to the third round, Kevin Lee looked pretty good, but he burned a little bit too hot in that. So we'll have a look at how this one goes. He's training at Killcliffe FC. And for Lee, I mean, that was another big thing. Michigan and then down to Vegas. And if you look at his fight against Tony Ferguson, he's got an old no-sleeve Dewey Cooper with him in that corner. We've seen Kevin Lee kind of mismatch some of his training together. He trained at TriStar for the longest time and now at Killcliffe. So if you do consider it, I have one weird thing about this fight, and I threw it out there on Twitter. Rinat Fakhretdinov relinquished his GFC middleweight belt because he didn't want to fight his Muslim brothers. He's taking on Kevin Lee in this fight, who is a Muslim. So it's going to be a little odd. But the thing with beliefs are, you can change them if you want. Wow. So that is a good thing. But we'll see if this fight takes place this weekend.
I'm just going to say something about Fakhretdinov because I've spent the last umpteen minutes going on about Kevin Lee. This is the thing about Fakhretdinov that it does worry me if you're a big fan of Kevin Lee and if you're a supporter of Lee. He makes you pay if he hits you with big shots. And if Kevin Lee is as susceptible to the power shot at 170 as we saw at 155, and there is reason to believe that, right? Daniel Rodriguez, although did knock him out, put him on skates how many times in that fight, really outstruck him. And Fakhretdinov might not have the same level of speed, but he does fight a little bit like Daniel Rodriguez in the way that...
Are you kidding? Not a chance.
No, he doesn't. But the way that he throws his strikes are from that odd angle where he'll hold his hands down and throw those over the top. I think he might be able to throw an odd shot and hurt Kevin Lee.
Daniel Rodriguez, I mean, we saw it last week.
Daniel Rodriguez is a
southpaw that they would call a technical brawler who boxes on the outside. Fakhretdinov is orthodox and throws big looping shots
those
like Alexei Olenek.
Those looping shots are what I mean, though. Those looping shots are the thing that have hurt Kevin Lee in the past, and I think they could hurt him again. Lee's a guy who holds his hands up very high, and he won't maneuver a lot after that. Those looping shots go around. I agree with you. It's not a perfect combination. Goodness, you're fired up.
Well,
but Fakhretdinov throws those looping shots that Kevin Lee's been hurt by. Look at Ally Quinta. He doesn't throw straight shots down the middle. He was throwing hooks that were hurting Kevin Lee.
We saw Fakhretdinov land that big shot from distance against Eric Spicely. The hooks were landing, kind of more of a right cross landed, and Spicely was down. Down goes Spicely.
A lot of people's introduction to
call her around the world. But Fakhretdinov fought good competition even before that. He beat Alberto Uda, who was in the UFC. He had some good wins. But it really is the fact that he has combat sambo and a little bit of that pancration to pull out of his back pocket to use in these fights. And in the UFC, two-fight sample size, Fakhretdinov, 2-0, scores 2-30-27, 2-30-26, 2-30-25, and a short right hand was the one that also dropped Brian Battle in that matchup in that third round. So if you look at it for Fakhretdinov, I mean, training at Evolve MMA with Demir Ismagulov, he is one of those guys that just grapples and grapples and grapples. And I thought the cardio would be an issue for Fakhretdinov at welterweight because he was previously a middleweight, but we haven't really seen that so far. But the biggest thing that scared me for Fakhretdinov outside of the UFC is throwing those big looping shots is awesome, but when your hands are below your chest and you have them chopper height, that's where you get hit yourself. And for Lee, from that southpaw stance, a lot of those big kicks, a lot of the head kicks,
he has a good jab too.
You have a good jab, and you saw him hurt, even in that first round against Tony Ferguson. He hurts Ferguson, and Ferguson, like David Onama, starts wiping that eye, and the commentary team goes, oh, it must have been an eye poke. It was a punch that Kevin Lee landed, and then he starts to rush in, drops his own hands, and Ferguson lands a left hook that drops Kevin Lee. So both of these guys with the striking, it can be 50-50. Both of them great with the wrestling in their own respect. For me, with Kevin Lee, three performance bonuses in the UFC. One against Mustafayev, one that he had against Chiesa, and one against, you talk about, where is he? Gregor Gillespie took that money after beating CDF, but where has he been? Just fishing in northern New York. If you look at it for Lee, he definitely has a shot, but he's not favored to win the matchup. Fakhretdinov is, I threw this one out there to everybody on our Twitter, at Fight Night Picks. Everybody's going with Fakhretdinov. So I'm going to look at the topology votes and say over under 80% Fakhretdinov. What say you?
Over, and I can't believe I'm saying that.
All right. It is over. So 810 total votes, 83% Fakhretdinov, 76% by decision. For the 17% that have Lee, 70% by decision. And for the millions watching on YouTube around the world, where Kamaru Usman said that Kevin Lee was a top 15 welterweight that they were watching that. In that fight. He actually said that.
Again, John Anik said Miranda Maverick was going to be fighting Valentina any day. So.
I thought Adolfo Vieira would be fighting for the belt by now. But when you look at a matchup like this, Lee plodding forward against Diego Sanchez and not really having success. But he looked really good in the grappling. Sanchez is a good grappler. So I do like Rinat Fakhretdinov with that motor on him. If Lee knocked him out, it wouldn't surprise me, because I was so down on Fakhretdinov striking coming into the UFC. But it's just the fact that it's takedown, rinse and repeat, and the top pressure of a guy like Fakhretdinov that I like him to win.
It's a weird fight, because if Kevin Lee loses the first round, I think he can win it. That's a weird thing to say, but Lee has a solid 11-minute burn to him. And if he loses the first round, that still gives him round 2 and 3 to go out there and wrestle, because cardio isn't his issue. It's pacing that's his issue. If you go and look at any of his fights, the Ally Quinta fight, the RDA fight, he's going out there and performing ridiculous takedowns at an insanely high level that really no athlete in the world can keep up for a solid 25 minutes or 15 minutes. So if Lee can fix his pacing issues, I think that would solve a lot in his career. I agree with you, though. I do have Fakhretdinov in this fight because the hooks in the boxing that he throws is going to eliminate some of those kicks from Lee. And Lee, when he's having the most success as a striker, is when he's moving forward, when he's working behind that jab, threatening with his own takedowns. And I just don't know if those threats are going to be there against a guy like Rinat.
A big-time matchup. I never thought I would say that I had Rinat Fakhretdinov to beat Kevin Lee, but I'm saying it right now. We'll see how it plays out on Saturday. I know you guys are fired up for this one. Let us know what you have down below in the comment section. In the fight, some big-time bangers left on this card, including Demir Ismagulov taking on Grant Dawson. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time middleweight banger coming up this weekend with Abdulrazak Alhassan out. It was announced on June 21st by Laerte Viana that in was Nursultan Ruziboyev. And listen, the nickname, it's Black. He's going to be taking on the Hulk, Bruno Fajeda. And if you look at a matchup like this for Bruno Fajeda, he takes on Gregory Rodriguez, his UFC debut, and just continues the streak. Bruno is 10-0 with 10 first round finishes, and he knocked out an established UFC veteran.
That's insane.
Just like that. So Bruno turns the page. Abdulrazak Alhassan would have been a great fight, but in on about 10 days notice is the guy representing Henzo Gracie Philly. It's Nursultan Ruziboyev. And if you look at it for Ruziboyev, he's one of those guys out of Uzbekistan. You haven't had a lot of fighters out of that country. You've had, Mahmud Muradov was the first. There was Zaruk Adashev. There was Said Yakub Kakrakmanov. But while Ruziboyev might not be the first, he probably won't be the last. And he comes in with a record similar to like a Max Grecian, but not against the same level of competition Max Grecian fought to come in. Because Ruziboyev, 34-8-2 with 2 no contests, where one of them was overturned because you had a phantom tap. It was like Ronnie Lawrence, Dan Argueta level. So Ruziboyev, he's on a tidy little win streak. He's been finishing everybody. He himself, out of 34 wins, 32 of them by finish, 24 in the first round. And going back and watching the tape is really interesting, because where Bruno Fajeda is a judo and jiu-jitsu black belt, but he's got hammers, Ruziboyev is one of those guys, and I'll be surprised if you saw the same tape that I did, because it's pretty readily available for the fighter out of Uzbekistan. The guy's the nail in every fight until he himself becomes the hammer.
And that's the interesting thing about him as a fighter, because he will give up disadvantageous positions, but kind of work his way through them. And we do see that with his threat of grappling in a lot of those spots. He does do a great job of threatening with submissions off of his back, and threatening not only with those submissions, but he's never in a stale position. And that's something that you do like to see really from any fighter. If I see one more fighter grab full guard and just hold on and look at the ref for 5 more minutes, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah, Ruziboev won't do that.
No, exactly. He's going to threaten with, and we both brought this up before we even started filming, the man loves a Kimura. Like, if he brings your arm home with him, he just puts another little notch in his own record, and he feels a lot better about himself, because it's a position that not only he tries to complete for a submission, that's his go-to to get out of bad positions. You'll see him try to get onto that Kimura, flip his opponent, and it is a great way to get out of spots. But the weird thing about Nursultan is, he is also susceptible to some of those, and he's a guy who will get into scrambles, get into a good spot, get into a bad spot, get back into said good spot. It's just always really difficult to predict how the fight's going to go as it's going on, because he'll end up in a great spot, look really dominant, and then he'll get half caught in a triangle choke, and then he'll kind of sweep his way out of that and threaten with another submission. There's just always a lot happening. Now, to his credit, I think that is going to be key against a fighter like Bruno, who is so, maybe one hit, one kill's not the right term, because he will throw in combination. The hand speed of Bruno's the thing that does catch you off guard. Like, for a guy who weighs 185 pounds, his hands move like Cody Garbrandt. That might be a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the idea. He is a bit of an outlier with not only his power but the hand speed. But I think if Nursultan can get him not just grappling but get him active throughout a lot of the matchup, I know a lot of his finishes are also in that first round, but I think the grappling can start to wear on Bruno and at least take off some of the zip of his punches. Now, even him at 80% is going to hit as hard as most fighters at 100%, but at least it gives yourself a much better chance to go out there and win the fight.
Yeah, so for Ruziboev, you look at it, 34-8-2 with the 2-0 contest, and then you break it down from there. He's got a couple of good wins out of all of that. He's got one over Ibrahim Mane, who you did see lose to Alan Amadovsky with Bellator, but Mane's a very good fighter. He went on a big win streak with Aris, and he just lost his last fight, but a good fighter. But in that one, it's a lot of takedown. It's for a one-round fight. It's a lot of takedown, switch position, and then you have Mane going for a triangle, and Ruziboev picks him up and slams him on his neck and knocks him out. Now, I would think in the UFC that would be an illegal move, and you just spiked a guy on his head.
But if you hold on to the submission, I think it's still legal, because that's how Rose lost to Justin Andrade.
It was definitely a strange one, but to go back and look at Ruziboev, his last time out, he takes on 12-12 Pavel Masalski, and in that one, that was last April, so he hasn't fought for a really long time. I don't know why the layoff, waiting for a big promotion, maybe that's it. But that one, I mean, he's wearing the Brave trunks, fighting for a different organization. Could you not buy the man some trunks? And Ruziboev, I mean, he struggles with the takedown in that fight. He fights really far on the outside from a southpaw stance and only throws, like, he'll throw a jab and then reset and then a one kick and then he circles away. Ruziboev doesn't cut the cage himself. He doesn't throw combinations. He's a really unorthodox striker. That fight was considered a middleweight contest, but it was at, like, the KG mark, so he actually fought at, like, around 198 if you do the conversion. But if you go back and you watch it, he gets taken down at the center of the cage, but he's going for, like, an armbar at the same time that he's getting taken down. He ends up getting into that, getting the submission win, so good one for him. I don't know if you saw the fight. He then took on, on a 7-hour, 38-minute, and 18-second stream, he took on a 39-year-old Brazilian jobber. And in that one, they show the graphic of what the two guys are good at. And it's like they're both national champions in everything in their respective nations. I found that one really weird. But in the fight, same thing. Fighter goes for takedown. He goes Kimura. He gets Kimura.
He loves the Kimura, guys. I can't stress this enough.
Ruziboev has bad takedown defense, but he's able to get submissions out of some of these spots. So for me, I look at this fight, Bruno Fajeda, judo black belt, jiu-jitsu black belt. You see him get it done with the striking. You see Ruziboev with maybe a little bit more pitter-patter with the striking, but his takedown defense isn't quite there. He has lost to some good fighters. The combined opponent record, 311, 162, and 2. So it is absolutely insane, though not the greatest fighters that he fought. Although, you know, you look at that record, and you might think that's shining. And to have that many fights before you're 29 is absolutely...
It's wild.
Before you're 30 is wild, especially after a year-long layoff. So you look at the matchup, Matt. I assume Bruno Fajeda is heavily favored. I assume the fans have him. we look at the topology votes, over under, I'm going to say 80% Bruno Fajeda in this one.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? Oh my. Wow. 523 total votes, 80% Fajeda, 84% by knockout. For the 20% that have Ruzi Boev, 48% by submission. I think Bruno Fajeda finishes Nursultan Ruzi Boev.
This is why. Nursultan's too comfortable moving backwards. Bruno
with
is...
with his hands down.
Could you imagine how scary the sight of Bruno moving forward with your hands down, locked in a cage with him would be? Like, this guy has life-altering power. He really does. When he hits most guys, there's not, like, a TKO afterwards. It's pretty much straight knockout. So, I've got Bruno in the matchup. I will be interested to see, though, if Nursultan can make this a more elongated fight in terms of, like you brought up with Kevin Lee, can you just make Bruno work and maybe take some of the zip out of his punches to see what he does look like in that second and third round?
Well, we will see how this fight matches up, Matt. If you do look at it, and a guy like Bruno Fajeda, who's giant up around these weight classes, I'm talking about Vitor Petrino. Those guys burn hot, and they get a lot of muscle to them. So look out for that as this one goes along. Both of us going with Bruno Fajeda in the matchup. A big-time middleweight banger in the main event. Sean Strickland taking on Abus Magomedov. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time lightweight action coming up this weekend in Vegas, the small cage. It's going to be home to Maheta, Ishmael Bonfim. And he's going to be taking on God of War, Benoit Saint-Denis. And Matt, this should be an all-timer. Oh, yeah. Because if you look at it for Benoit Saint-Denis, the background, little bit of judo. Then he was in, you know, the SAS, the French Special Forces. He got accustomed to jiu-jitsu. He's rounded out his striking as he's gone along at the Venom Training Center in Paris. And if you look at it for Saint-Denis, his last two fights out after the Eliseu Zaleska de Santos fight, he looked great against the Green Mask, Nicolas Stutz, and his last time out, he fought part-time weekend fighter Gabriel Miranda, and it was wild. It was one of those performance of the night bonuses in the second round, but both those two guys went at it. Saint-Denis striking dropped one Gabriel Miranda at 3 points in that fight. Now, I counted 4 knockdowns, but 2 in the first round, 2 in the second round. Saint-Denis, the floor was lava against Fly Miranda's jiu-jitsu, but Saint-Denis really shone in that fight. And for Bonfim, I mean, just continues to win the boxing pedigree, but his last time out, over 4,000 topology votes on that fight against Terrence McKinney. 80% McKinney, and Bonfim classed him, pieced him up on the striking, landed that knee, and looked amazing in that matchup. We talked a lot about Bonfim coming into that fight, so let's throw it on back to that for a second. But when you look at a Ishmael Bonfim, just like his brother Gabriel, he has a record in boxing. 24-3 as an amateur, 4-1 as a pro, but one of the guys that he beat, like that was from 2016 to 2018, was 5-29-1, so it wasn't the greatest level competition in boxing, but a record to have nonetheless. And from Ishmael, as good as he is with his striking, he's very well-rounded. And I think Gabriel might be the better of the Bonfim brothers, even though Ishmael has some losses. It is against better competition. But for Ishmael, what he can do so well is counter and bait you into a lot of those shots, back up, and he does move his head quite well. And then again, his left hook is one of his best shots, and he looks to land it quite a bit. Now, again, could he get caught with the lean back and he gets hit by a big shot? I bet, and I'm sure we're going to hear that from you in the comment
section.
And
that's why we talk about the lean back being a bad defensive move. Like, good defensive strikers slip. They don't lean.
He reminds me a lot, though, of his teammate from Serrato MMA, in a guy like Vicente Luque, kind of waiting, baiting, keeping his hands up, yeah, and then looking to counter-strike on that recoil. Again, a thing that I do like out of him is he can also throw his left hand, not just as a traditional hook, but as a bit of a shovel hook in some of his fights, just a different angle that you have to look for. So if you remember out of that Bonfim fight against McKinney, it was actually a really early knee from McKinney that landed a Bonfim, and then Bonfim goes, what of it? And then he started to get the Brazilian crowd into it. Awesome to see that. A giant performance bonus for Bonfim in that matchup. His brother then fought later. Crazy to see those two brothers competing, but you look at a fight like this where Bonfim's got some jiu-jitsu and some get-ups. He showed really good takedown defense and actually worked the takedown against a good wrestler, McKinney. So that's going to play out a little bit in this fight against Saint-Denis. And Saint-Denis' striking continues to get better. It's not where Bonfim's is.
I was going
to
say.
But you look at a fight like this, I'm sure Vyacheslav Kislyaev's probably not going to watch this fight. He loves the fight. But Matt, when you look at a fight like this, are you as excited as I am? Because I think the fans should be.
I'm really excited for this fight, but I liken it to our school bus growing up, going up that big hill near where we live, and I'll just leave it at that. Because for Saint Denis, he's going to have to give it his all to get over the hump, and he's really going to have to be active. He's going to have to be like the driver, just putting the pedal to the metal and letting it spin. Because for Saint Denis, it is going to be difficult for him to excel in a lot of just straight one areas. Now, I do think his wrestling is going to be active enough for him to go out there and get takedowns against a guy like Bonfim, but you bring it up. Bonfim is not some zero on the mat. He has defensive submissions off the initial takedown, and he does some good get-ups. He likes to go for those butterfly hooks, kind of like BJ Penn, kick to get back up, and... Prime BJ Penn, not this new iteration, but he does have the grappling pedigree to where if he does get taken down, I don't necessarily worry about it completely, but I do think Saint Denis can have a lot of success from that top position, but even for Saint Denis, I think it's just going to be a matter of being a mixed martial artist to his fullest totality, because if he can use his activity, then he does have good activity, he's got good striking, good wrestling, and he's not someone who's going to completely fall off a cliff. Like, we even saw that in the Elysio fight. He was getting beat pillar to post, but in the third round, he was still in that fight. So I think for Saint Denis, it does come down to how long can he just make Bonfim work and be active? Because I do think during a lot of those active moments, Saint Denis can win. But if Bonfim is able to initiate his boxing, let's say he kind of does what a lot of guys started to do to Jack Hermanson, just defend all of his initial takedown attempts and force him to become a striker. Because if he is able to have that kind of a game plan, I do think his boxing combinations are quite superior to Saint Denis.
I bet Benoit Saint Denis, when he was in the 7th grade, had back hair like one of my friends did. Just built like a man when you're 12. If you look at it for Benoit Saint Denis, a very young 27, but he's aged through this process. And if you look at it for him, I mean, even in the fight against Miranda, Saint Denis gets rocked, and then he lands a spinning back fist that lands, and then a couple of seconds later, spinning back elbow that lands. Like, Saint Denis got incredibly creative in that fight against Miranda to get that performance bonus. And now, I mean, two guys off of performance bonuses against one another, it'll be great to see. And if Saint Denis can get another win over a Brazilian, I mean, do you put him back in Rio again, like at UFC 283? A night where 9-8 were the Brazilian fighters, but there was some Brazil-to-Brazil violence, as we have in our next fight with Ariane Lipski taking on Melissa Gatto. But if you do consider this matchup, I mean, Saint Denis is one of those fighters, if you go back and watch him with Brave, lightweight, the welterweight, the 165 experience, you look at the no contest that was on his record, he was losing the fight against Paul Kiliak, and at the end of it, they raised his opponent's hand because there was a cut on Saint Denis, but after the fact, they ruled it a no contest due to a clash of heads, and it was one of those situations where the ring looked like the Cage Warriors ring, and it was Ross Houston, Nicholas Dalby. Oh. Going back and watching that fight today was a lot of fun, though. So if you look at it for Saint Denis, he puts a lot of his brawn into his takedowns, but they are very good. The judo's good. The jiu-jitsu's good. You've seen the striking lately against Stutz and against Miranda, but you know he can get it done at all facets. And Bonfim, a very, very good boxer, but a speedy boxer too. I think in some of those spots where you saw Miranda kind of wilt a little bit when the striking got tough, Bonfim's one of those guys. He's in, he's out. He's not in on a line either, and he moves his head quite well to throw those combinations. His left hook's a laser. His right cross is great, too. So there's look out for those in these matchups. I mean, Bonfim is favored quite a bit. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise us, air to you. I think it's going to be competitive until it's not for one of these guys. I'm going to say over under 75% Bonfim here.
I'll say over because he is the much more damaging striker.
And it is 759 total votes, 86% Bonfim, 31% by decision, 59% by knockout for the 14% that have Benoit Saint-Denis, 50% by decision, 18% by knockout. And I think Saint-Denis can have success in the first round of this matchup. I think Bonfim can carry it a little bit as it goes along, but I just like the movement on the feet of a guy in Bonfim. And for me, kind of check that box of the wrestling against McKinney to where I can see him having success against Saint-Denis. But I think Bonfim's got a speed advantage over a lot of the lightweights out there.
I would agree. I really do think Bonfim's one of the more complete boxers in this division. I'm not saying that means he's going to win the title.
I think his really brother Gabriel's better, which is crazy.
They're really good at fighting. It's kind of insane. But for I also have Bonfim in the matchup. But I can see this going to a decision. I know a lot of the Tapology voters see this ending by knockout, but I do think Saint Denis is going to be in there for the fight. We've seen him take a lot of damage. I think his takedowns are going to help him evade some of that damage too, just get his head out of some bad positions. But I think this should be an incredible fight because that's the thing. Saint Denis will force the action against a guy like Bonfim and really make him initiate a lot of those big power shots.
Let us know who you have down below in the matchup. Both of us going with Maheta, Ismael Bonfim, to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including the queen of violence. She's taking on Melissa Gatto. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Getting ready for a fight like this is like Clay Guida getting ready for a fight. The queen of violence time! We have Ariane Lipsky representing Lioness Studio, looking to go 2-0 from the gym that Amanda Nunes has made popular when she takes on a couple of Brazilians, Melissa Gatto. And if you look at this matchup, Matt, Gatto inactive for about a year, her last time out against Tracy Cortez. Cortez round one, Gatto round two. Gatto a little bit playing jiu-jitsu, hanging around on the ground in round three against Cortez, loses 29-28 on all three judges' scorecards. But for Gatto, if you consider it, you look at her undefeated coming into the UFC, the USADA issues marking the little bit of a pause from 2018 to 2021, but win over Victoria Leonardo, kicks her arm and breaks it, win over Sajara Eubanks, kicks her body, wins it. So if you consider for Gatto, big time performance bonus against Sajara Eubanks, and her striking night and day from when she was on the regional scene to her in the UFC. Gatto trains out of a really good gym in Equipe, MSP, so a really good one there for Gatto. A lot of great fighters out of the gym. And if you look at it for Lipsky, Brazil to ATT to then Lioness Studio, and it did look good on her last time out. Now, 30-27s across the board when she took on JJ Aldrich, mixed in the takedowns, mixed in the distance complete striking. I don't know if it was a JJ Aldrich-Cody Brundage situation, because Aldrich looked a step slow in that matchup, but I'll give the flowers and the credit where they're due. I thought Lipsky looked good to where Aldrich didn't look great. So it was a sink or swim moment. Lipsky kind of saved her spot in the division. And now all of a sudden, we're kind of pining for the rankings in a matchup like this at flyweight, just outside of the top 15. So it's a fun fight because Lipsky, we've seen that knee bar against Luana Carolina. That's got to be a meme because they're both fighting on this card this weekend. But Lipsky, the submission of the year with that knee bar, it was disgusting.
God, that's pretty good, though.
Melissa Gatto, you saw her get that submission against Carol Hosa to punch her ticket to the UFC. So a really interesting fight coming up this weekend.
If anybody tells you they know exactly what's going to happen in this fight, you look them dead in the eyes and tell them they're a liar. Because Melissa Gatto is one of these fighters that I really hate predicting. Like a Fabricio Verdum, and I'm not talking about the striking. I'm just thinking primarily about jiu-jitsu.
Wait, you mean
Brad Ortega.
Whoa. Bare knuckles Fabricio Verdum?
Is that really what he's doing right
taking
now?
Taking on JDS.
That's real sad. Anyways, any of these Flores Lava type fighters, and I know Melissa Gatto might not be of that level, right? Like we did see Tracy Cortez have success with her own offensive takedowns, but for the most part, Gatto and her submission ability is enough of a threat so that the majority of people don't even want to go into those waters with her. But other than getting the fight to some of those positions, yes, the body kick is something that has improved a lot. Her striking is coming along, but I still don't think Melissa Gatto's striking is at the level to where she can go out there and win 15-minute fights strictly with her striking. Now, I think her striking can open up her grappling, and that can lead her to wins during those 15-minute fights, but she's a difficult fighter to predict, with which she relies on her opponents to take her down sometimes. Her offensive takedowns, they're not the most crisp. She's not a complete zero with her offensive takedowns, but it is a lot of rushing across. She's using her physical strength. But the thing about Gatto is, off her back, yes, she's dangerous. If she gets on top of Ariane Lipsky in this matchup, I don't want to say it's over, but she is a completely different type of a threat with her own submission game. But I have to go back and agree with what we kind of both said about the Aldrich fight. It was a complete performance from Lipsky. And if you're a complete fighter who fights somebody who is primarily a specialist, although yes, we all recognize she's making the improvements in the other parts of her game, I still think the completeness of Lipsky is always going to be something that specialists are going to have a difficult time overcoming.
The Lipsky thing, it was a bit of a question mark trying to make the weight. She had a couple of bouts there at 135, at
concerning.
Around 135. She had COVID right before a fight, and that kind of threw things into flux. And now all of a sudden, out of the ATT realm, she looked really good her last time out. So it is kind of credit where credit's due. And Lipsky, you know how high the hopes were. She was in the middle of a KSW poster, albeit fighting for a title on the prelims against, Diana Belvizia. She fought Silvana Gomez-Juarez. She has a win over Sheila Gaff, who was somebody that Amanda Nunes beat in the UFC. So kind of crazy to see the similarities there. But a national Muay Thai champ to go along with that KSW belt for Lipsky. And I mean, it's one of those ones where you look at it at Lipsky and training at Lioness Studio, you might go, maybe that's to kind of a reduced level. And we talked about the striking coach that we have for Amanda Nunes. But I think kind of the unsung hero getting ready for a fight like this is Desmond Moore being a coach there with Lipsky, with Amanda Nunes as well. He's a guy that wrestled at Penn State. And though he has a 7-5 MMA record, it's not really conducive to the fact that this guy was a heck of a wrestler and he's going to get you schooled for a fight like this. And if you're sitting at home going, Sheila Gaff, Desmond Moore, who are these people? You probably, and I think you should leave fan, and you're probably sitting there going, who the hell is Bart Lee? Ever heard of John Richter? No! I don't know if people watch season 3 as much as I did, but I loved it. So if you do look at this one, Matt, Melissa Gatto coming off about a year-long layoff. She is favored in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprised us, air to you. I think they're going to be closer than some of these other fights have been with Tapology. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Gatto here.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? Oh, look at you. 772 total votes, 64% Gatto, 71% to win by decision. For the 36% that have Lipsky to win, 81% by decision. I think Ariane Lipsky wins a decision in this fight. I don't see Gatto beating Lipsky by decision.
If she gets a ton of ground control, I think she could. I agree. It's probably the most unlikely. It's probably the most unlikely out of the outcomes. But again, I think if Gatto is able to get on top, probably if she has that much top control, it's probably over by submission. So I'll agree with you. I have a hard time with this fight. Because again, if Lipsky can keep it on the feet, keep it a rangy fight, and really use her own kicks too. Because that's the thing. Lipsky has her own prodding kicks that can keep this fight so far away from Gatto that Gatto's takedowns won't be nearly as effective. So I'll go with the slight underdog in Ariane Lipsky in this one.
Both of us going with the queen of violence, Ariane Lipsky, to get the win. Let us know down below who you have in the matchup. Some big time fights left on this card, including Demiris Magulov is going to be taking on Grant Dawson. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Welterweights collide in the small UFC Apex Octagon coming up this weekend. Max Griffin might be 7-7 with the promotion, but he's 4-1 in the 5-on-in, and he's looking to gatekeep the top 15 when he takes on the up-and-coming undefeated Ecuadorian prospect Michael Morales. Only the second Ecuadorian fighter after Chito Vera to make that UFC debut. And Morales, I mean, already 2-0. But it's been about a year since we last saw him. Wins over Adam Fugit as well as Trevin Giles, former Morales, who beat Nikolai Verentetnikov over on Dana White's Contender Series, utilizing some really good takedowns on that one. And we talked about it. I mean, Morales coming into the UFC was known less for striking than he was for his grappling, a national champ in wrestling in Ecuador. His parents, both martial artists, his mom over on his Instagram, still competing for jiu-jitsu belts and jiu-jitsu tournaments,
very
I guess.
Impressive.
So cool to see for Morales, who trains out of Entram Gym with some of the best in the world, and a short way from Tijuana to Vegas. Same can be said for Max Griffin, going from California down to Vegas. But for Max Griffin, one of those interesting guys, because really well known on the regional scene in the States. He fought Chidi Njokuani years ago when he was the Tachi Palace champ at welterweight. And I'll throw that one up there. Cinco de Mayhem.
Wild.
That punched the ticket for a 26-year-old sultry voice, Chidi Njokuani, to go on a run with Bellator to then win and win and win and win and fight Andrei Korshkov to a loss. But if you look at it for Max Griffin, a bit of a rocky road coming into the UFC, or when he came into the UFC, he debuted when Nate Diaz fought Conor McGregor the second time at UFC 202 against Colby Covington. And for Griffin, even in the losses, you look at his fight against Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos, where he drops him a couple of times.
That's one of the greatest fights of all time that nobody ever talks about.
The thing in my mind's eye, I go, Max Griffin gets put on skates in some of his fights. But if you look at the knockdown ratio, 8-4-1 against, Max Griffin doesn't go down. He stays up, and he just continues to bite down on the mouthpiece. So I looked a lot into that Griffin fight that he had against Zaleski. Even though he dropped him at points, he got completely outpointed. He got rocked in the first round
several
times. So if you do watch a Griffin fight, what does he do well? Doesn't throw any kicks. Kind of has a weird stance to him. Throws a nice jab, a nice right cross, and he just continues to march and march and march. And Max Griffin, good takedown defense and good offensive takedowns too on him. That's why he makes for a tough test outside of the top 15 for Michael Morales.
And that's why he's the perfect test for Michael Morales at this stage of his career, because we're all kind of waiting for Morales to have that one big test at the UFC level. And I do think
if you haven't watched Morales' UFC fights, he's been tested the whole time.
I understand. But against a guy like Max Griffin, who, like you say, gatekeeps the top 15, when you beat Max Griffin, what happens to you? only phenomenal things. And the thing about Griffin is, I feel like a Max Kellerman every time I talk about him. When Kellerman used to talk about Tom Brady, remember the cliff theory? He was like, he's gonna fall off a cliff and then Tom Brady would just go and win another Super Bowl. I feel like every fight for Max Griffin, since I do predict, hey, he's a great boxer, but we've seen him get hit, we see him get hurt. When is that chin finally going to evade him? When is he going to fall into that kind of Matt Brown category of his career? Because he's 37 years old, he's not a young 37 with the amount of tough fights he's been through, but like you say, he's got a bend but don't break kind of chin to him. I just worry that in a matchup like this, if he does go in with his hands down, if he's not able to move forward in the matchup, and that's why I think the big thing with Max Griffin is, when he moves forward, he can threaten with his own takedown and implement his own boxing. When he's the guy getting backed up, it does kind of eliminate the wrestling from his own game.
And it's tough because Morales has been out for about a year. He just turned 24 in the last week, and if you watch him fight outside of the UFC, a really good kick, a really good jab, really good offensive takedowns, and then you crystallize it to the two UFC fights, and they're both finishes, and they're both great. Not throwing the jab, winging his hands out there, going for kind of offset takedowns and not getting them. He got taken down by Trevin Giles. He was losing that fight until he kind of swings a shot that hits in tight against Giles, puts him on Beach Street, and then he just follows it up with a crazy blitz and drops Giles again against Adam Fugit. Close first round, close second round, third round, he drops Fugit and drops him again and gets the win. For Michael Morales, I've almost seen a regression of the skills, even though he's won these two fights. If you don't watch them, then it doesn't make sense what I'm saying. But Morales hasn't really shown us the fundamentals, and I wonder if over the last year he's just kind of honed in on them. I hope he has.
I think he's 24. I just think he's a young guy who does have a very high ceiling. So when we don't get the very highest version of it, it does leave a little bit to be desired. And you're right. I was so high on this guy coming into the UFC because he has the very crisp striking from the outside. He can throw a straight shot and a looping shot. And when he resorts to a lot of those looping shots, it leaves the door open for Max Griffin to start landing some of those counters. Because the thing about Griffin that I think does help him maintain some of that chin is he does move his head on the inside now. He doesn't always do it. That's the thing about Griffin. On the outside, I do worry about him. The kicks have been a bit of an issue, and you bring it up. It's not something offensively he throws a lot in his game. So if he comes up against an opponent who can maintain that range and really implement their own kicks, Griffin, not that he gets stationary because he is a very high-volume fighter no matter what, but it makes it that much more difficult for him not only to land the jab, but the power shot that he can follow it up with.
And we had a fight like this last weekend at welterweight. You talk about common opponents. I mean, the Neil Magny fight against Phil Rowe. Phil Rowe, long-rangey, but fights in tight. Neil Magny, long-rangey, normally fights at range, but when they both collided and went into the clinch, it was Magny ended up winning a lot of those circumstances. So you look at a fight like this, Morales, one of the bigger guys you're going to find at welterweight. A lot more tattoos since last year.
Griffin's not a small guy, though, for the weight class.
And Griffin's a dense fella at 5'11", even though that's not a short fighter by any stretch of the imagination at welterweight. Morales is heavily favored in the fight, albeit it seems like Max Griffin is a perennial underdog in his matchups. We have a look at the Tapology votes. The fans like Morales. I'm going to say over under 85% Morales in this one.
I want to say under, but it's probably over.
Yeah, slightly over. 813 total votes, 88% Morales, 24% by decision, 67% by knockout. For the 12% that have Griffin, 68% by decision, 24% by knockout. And Morales, if he can't get through that guard of Max Griffin, who keeps his body out of distance, and if Morales can't land the kicks because Griffin's able to check him, it could be a tough night out.
I just worry about him landing that big shot and if Griffin can recover afterwards. I know he has been able to, but at 37 with this many times of him getting wobbled, I do worry about him. And maybe I've counted Max Griffin out too many times at this point, but I do think this is a very winnable fight for Michael Morales. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if Max Griffin's the guy who kind of not derails the hype train, but really teaches him a lesson. And this could be one of those fights where Roosevelt Roberts lost to Jim Miller, and I thought it was going to be the best thing ever for him, right? You lose to a guy like that, then you go and rebuild. This could be one of those fights where Morales loses and it becomes a better fighter because of it.
Roosevelt Roberts, Ultimate Fighter winner. I mean, that guy's going to go great places, Matt, in the matchup. Both of us going with Michael Morales. I think the wrestling edge can carry him, but Max Griffin's shown really good wrestling defense in the UFC. He can pour it on you offensively. And if you want to see a great Max Griffin fight where he continues to build as it goes on, his fight against Ramiz Brahimi, the elbows to that ear were disgusting. So go back and watch some tape on these two guys. Both of us going with Ecuador's Morales to get the win. Now it's time for that big time co-main event. Is Magulov taking on Dawson? You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
B big time. Co-main event this weekend at lightweight. A couple of men who have called American Top Team home at one time or another. We have Demir Ismagulov off that retirement talk. He's going to be taking on KGD Grant Dawson. And if you look at it for Ismagulov, getting ready for his last matchup against Armin Tsarukyan, two guys that trained at American Top Team and Tiger Muay Thai, Ismagulov at TMT, and then he had Tsarukyan at ATT. And Armin Tsarukyan, though he only went 7-21 on takedown attempts in that fight, that really was the story of it. All three judges, 30-27. Ismagulov, after the fact, goes on to Instagram. I'll throw it up there. He retires. And then a couple of days later, he says, well, I've got one fight left on my UFC contract. I hope the UFC run it back and I rematch Tsarukyan. And they went, what? No, it wasn't even a close fight. So ultimately, Ismagulov, the giant win streak is snapped. And now he's taking on an up-and-coming, a hungry Grant Dawson. Throw whatever adjectives or superlatives that you want. He's on his own tidy 10-fight win streak. You pepper in the draw that he had against Ricky Glenn due to the 10-8 third round that Glenn was able to throw out there. And that is what it is for Grant Dawson. Two big wins his last couple of fights. Couple of finishes, too. One against Jared Gordon. I mean, my guy Leo Santos, that was sad to watch. But if you look at it for Grant Dawson, even in the Mark Madsen fight, it's a great submission win. Grant Dawson's one of those guys. Like, one part of my favorite drink. Matt, I'm a big fan of Fever Tree ginger beer. And I like to drink it on its own. I like to drink it as part of a mule. No, I like drinking Moscow mules on the weekend. But when I look at their slogan, it's the silliest one that's out there. It's, if 3/4 of your drinks is mix with the best. Matt, Grant Dawson, 3/4 or more of his drink is jiu-jitsu. And trying to mix everything into it can be a little bit of a struggle sometimes. And we saw that against Nad Nirimani. We've seen that against, well, Leo Santos at the start of the fight.
Exactly. That was a difficult fight for him.
Grant Dawson has struggled with the other quarter of the fighting, and that's been the striking. And we've seen it kind of progress a little bit at ATT since he went from Glory to ATT before the mass exodus. So good move on Grant Dawson, I guess. But it's going to be tough for him against a guy like Ismagulov, who it was bend but don't break takedown defenses last time out against Tsarukyan. But Ismagulov's one of the better boxers you're going to find out there at 155, who doesn't tend to use a lot of kicks. I know he's like that old Dutch kind of fable, winking, blinking, and nod, where he will do the blink that's out there. It's more of a tick than anything. It's not that he's hurt in his fights. But Ismagulov on the outside, peppering you with the jab and the 1-2, he can be a big problem for a lot of these fighters.
And that's why I think Grant Dawson really has to get this fight to the ground. Wow, Matt, what a hot take. But you bring it up, Demir Ismagulov has been taken down in the past, but what he is great at is it's difficult to complete the takedown on him. You might get him off his base, but the second you initiate any kind of a scramble with him, he's digging an underhook, he's forcing the wizard, he's getting back up to his feet, and he doesn't allow himself to get controlled for lengthy periods of time. But that's where Grant Dawson and his skill set really does come into play. Because even if he does get one of those 6 of 29, 6 of 28, whatever it is, takedown attempts, he only needs that one to really get enough work done in the top position. And that's the thing about Dawson that you do like. Outside of the submissions, he is quite heavy with his ground and pound as well. He will go for a lot of elbows as well. And so Dawson doesn't just rely on submission or nothing once he gets it on the ground. So I do think he can accumulate some damage. But with that being said, it's difficult to just take Demir Ismagulov down and have success, not just minute after minute, but round after round. And I think Grant Dawson, outside of a stoppage, is really going to have to rely on a lot of that top control. So for Ismagulov, you bring it up, not just the boxing, the jab of Demir is phenomenal. And if he is able to use his own jab to keep Grant Dawson away, it's going to be that much harder for Dawson to get on the inside to complete his own takedown attempts.
You got a little bit of a Rod Stewart, Maggie May going on here, a little bit of a frog in the throat. But if you look at it, Matt, I mean, for Ismagulov in this matchup, retirement talk scares a lot of people. And when you say that one fight left in the UFC way back in January, it gets buried away and people forget about it. But not here at Fight Night Picks. So if you look at it for Ismagulov, he blew the doors off of just about everybody until he fought Rafael Alves, who dropped him in the first 30 seconds of that round of their fight.
Remember that reversal, too?
But then all of a sudden, it was the rest of the round. Hammer is Ismagulov, nail is Alves. And the third round of that fight ended up being halfway competitive. If you look at it for Ismagulov, majority had thought that Kutateladze won their split decision fight. But if you look at a matchup like this, again, it is the boxing on the outside of Ismagulov. He does conserve his gas tank really well. He's a 5-round trained fighter, being the former M1 Global champ. But if you look at it, a lot of inactivity throughout his UFC career, and that's why even though he had a slow burn to the top 15, it wasn't really as pronounced as some other fighters have been.
It's like having Paul George on your team. When he's out there, it looks phenomenal, but all the inactivity in between does leave you with a lot of question marks. And like you say, if Ismagulov, I don't think this is his mindset. Let me get this very clear, but you have to bring it up. If Ismagulov is just like, hey, it's the last fight of my contract, like, let's just get this over with, right? Like, that could be an option for him. I don't believe that is. I could even see him getting a win, maybe, and then that kind of relighting the fire under him. Now, at 32 years old, he is going to have to kind of get working at a certain point, because lightweight division is as deep and as stacked as any division, but this is a great fight, because I do think Dawson has some defined areas of his skill set where he can have success. It would be wild to see him just maintaining that top spot, hammering down on Ismagulov, but Dawson, I do think, does have that kind of top control.
Hit him, Kim Kearns. If you look at it, I mean, Ismagulov's right now in a category...
All right, Burpee McGee.
Piotr... I didn't. Not in this video.
In the majority. Settle down.
Piotr Jan reached the pinnacle, won the title, and it's been a landslide since. Askar Askarov reached near the pinnacle, and then he lost the fight, and that was it. He was outside of the UFC. Ismagulov is in that spot right 100%. Now in his career. And he's training at Evolve to get ready for this one. He's training with Rinat Fakhradinov. You've seen him out there. You've seen time at Tiger Muay Thai as well throughout the career. But if you consider for Ismagulov, again, I'll be interested to see if he does at least throw kicks in this fight, because he is a two-thirds to the head, third to the body, and rarely ever kick type of fighter, which could ultimately win him the distance battle in this matchup, except for if they end up in a clinch position. That's where Dawson can start feeding the uppercuts and just going Marge Simpson on this fight. So if you look at it, Ismagulov is favored to get the win. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Ismagulov.
I have a really hard time with this. I'll say over, though.
I'm going to say over. It's slightly under. So 835 total votes, 68% Ismagulov, 88% by decision for the 32% that have Dawson, 65% by decision. And I mean, Dawson primarily known as a finisher, so I'm kind of surprised that everybody sees it going to a decision in this one.
I just think Ismagulov's so good defensively that even if Dawson is able to get it into some of those positions he excels at, yes, he might be able to get a lot of that top control. He'll get some ground and pound, but I think it's going to be difficult for Grant Dawson to submit a guy like Demir Ismagulov. It's really difficult for Dawson to go and get some of that back control. Now, if he is able to complete some of those takedowns, and especially early, I think that's going to be the key. The numbers might not look great. It might hurt his overall takedown accuracy numbers, but if Dawson can just get some of those early takedowns to make Ismagulov work, because here's the thing about Demir, he has all the skill in the world, but if he's down two rounds, what is he going to do in that third round to go out there and get the stoppage? Yes, he has good power, but he doesn't have like Dustin Poirier, Michael Chandler power. He has good submissions, good grappling, but again, he's not like a Charles Oliveira, so I'm very interested to see how does Demir fight if he isn't in the lead. I still have him in the matchup, though. Hopefully we brought up enough red flags. I think if everything was the same and Demir didn't kind of retire the last time out, then I would have him quite soundly in the matchup. But with all the red flags, I do think this is a very close fight.
Going with the well-roundedness out of Demir Ismagulov to pick up the win, but we'll see if that retirement talk looms large. Some big-time fights on this card overall. But the next one's the biggest of them all. We're talking about Sean Strickland taking on Abus Magomedov. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And thanks so much for joining in with Fight Night Picks. You guys, the Fight Night Picks fans, you voted for it. Our thumbnail for the video, we went funky with it. And coming up this weekend, middleweight main event, you have Sean Strickland in his fifth five-rounder with the UFC taking on Abus Magomedov, the former PFL million-dollar finalist, and he's in just his second UFC fight. He knocked out Dustin Stoyanovich in under a minute to make that UFC debut. After years away, so awesome stuff out of Magomedov in that fight. I mean, as always, one half your host to do with Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen, FNP, respective socials. But we look at this fight, and you have a couple of primary strikers. And if you consider it for Strickland, we know the combinations. That 2-3's coming at you all
he's
day.
He's right there.
And he's going to pepper that jab in there. For Abus Magomedov, he's all over the map with the striking, but it is great. It's crisp, it's clean, and it's a lot of fun to watch at a UFD gym over in Germany. But Magomedov, one of those guys that you're trying to kind of pick the brain of some of the strikers that train at UFD. There have been a litany of them. Obviously, I think the highlight in recent memory didn't go well for him in one championship in the debut or the second fight, but Roberto Soldic. But if you look at it for a guy like Magomedov, set up the blueprint in one UFC fight, get yourself a main event. And we talked a lot about Abbas Magomedov when he was making that debut against Stoicefus, to the fact where Matt ended up making himself a meme. Abbas Magomedov to the UFC. And for Magomedov, his Keith Richards, start me up, I never stop. Well, his never stop stopping UFC tenure. Now that sounds like that Lonely Island movie that bombed. But for Magomedov, he was signed to the UFC back in August of 2021. I mean, for Abbas Magomedov, he was booked against Gerald Meerschaert in December. He was booked against Ali Eskab Hezria back in March of this year. He was booked against Muradov, and now he ends up taking on Dustin Stoicefus. And UFC fans, MMA fans, Fight Night Picks fans, you might know Magomedov because he was a PFL finalist in their original season. He was put on a poster by Bilal Muhammad's teammate, Lewis Taylor, in that fight, got knocked out by a left hook.
That's going to happen, though.
It's going to happen sometimes. But if you look at it for his season overall, he had two first-round finishes. He had a majority draw on the playoffs night, because you fight twice in one night. So majority draw in the two-round fight, in the three-round fight, he was able to get a unanimous decision win to move on. If you look at Abbas Magomedov, he hasn't fought very often at all. His last fight was almost 2 years ago against Cezary Kezik over with KSW. And my God, did he look good in that fight. And he put Kezik to sleep with a front choke in that one. So pretty cool stuff from Magomedov. Before that, a big win over with EMC. 3 years and 3 months ago, and you might go, hey, I remember that PFL season. Was that like 4 years ago? Yeah, it was. It was 2018. So for Magomedov, hasn't fought very often. You look at the last name, and you look at that tweet that Aaron Bronstetter put out back in July that fighters with Magomedov in their name like 84% of the time in the UFC. I like that. And I really like Abbas Magomedov's style, because you might look at his last name and go, well, this guy's a grappler. He won his last fight by submission. This guy's a striker, and it's like watching a K1 artist at the purest form strike in MMA. He really is a lot of fun from either stance, looks like a Thai fighter. I really do like Magomedov's style, and I think he's a fun fighter. It's just, he hasn't fought in forever, and he doesn't fight very often.
I don't know if he's Rico Verhoeven.
I have no idea what we're going to get out of him this week.
With Abbas Magomedov, I do really like his striking style. I think he can go to the legs against Dustin. I think he is going to be able to use his boxing very effectively against Stoicefus. And if Abbas Magomedov just doesn't respect the striking power of Dustin Stoicefus, I think he is just going to be able to walk forward and walk forward and walk forward.
You made yourself a meme in the fact that you didn't know you were making yourself into a meme, because you said that Magomedov could just throw caution to the wind, not respect Dustin Stoicefus, and knock him dead. And boy, did he ever with that front kick. Wow. So Abbas Magomedov, second coming of Anderson Silva. And now he gets this fight against Sean Strickland that was a head scratcher in his book, because it's 18 fights now for Sean Strickland in the UFC. And he's a 7th ranked fighter against a guy in his second fight in Magomedov.
I think you'll agree with me on this, though. We might disagree on what the best division is in the UFC, right?
It's not middleweight.
I think it's lightweight. We both agree middleweight's probably the weakest of the divisions. If any unranked fighter is going to beat a ranked fighter who's pretty well known, it's probably going to be the middleweight division. Just because a lot of the fighters in that kind of 8 down, like the top 6 is kind of set. You have Robert Whittaker, you have Israel Adesanya, you have Mervin Vettori, Jared Cannonier. Sean Strickland is kind of in that category, but he has lost to a number of those guys at this point. I know he's beat a lot of those guys too, but that's the weird thing about Strickland. That's why I do love this matchup. You bring it up. You just know what his skill set is. There's no question marks with Sean Strickland. I don't think he's going to show up throwing spinning back kicks like Chris Weidman did against Luke Rockhold. Just the worst idea anybody's ever had. No, he's going to be what got him to the dance, and that is that in-your-face kind of boxer. And I do think that pressure is going to be important, because Magomedov, when he struggles against anybody, is guys who will stay in his face and can eliminate some of those kicks. It's a story old as time. Fedor Emelianenko fought Mirko Krokop, and guess what Fedor did? He fought really close to him, and nobody knew why. But if you eliminate the kick of your opponent, you get really close to him, and you force him to become a boxer. And I do think Strickland can follow a similar game plan, but Magomedov on the outside is a very effective kicker, and I do think it's weird. We say this about most of the guys Strickland fights. If they only kick his leg more, think of the success they have. But Strickland is very good defensively with that position now at this stage of his career.
Sean Strickland, after he won in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, not that long after, had a motorcycle accident and lost the top or part of this, his kneecap. And you'd think guys would just go at the knee, but nobody's able to have the success, because once he starts rolling downhill with his boxing, that's when you beat him. Now, people discredited Jared Cannonier's, the 49-46s that he had on two scorecards, and they looked at the Strickland split decision 49-46, and they went, hey, Strickland did pretty well against Cannoneer. No, he didn't, because Cannoneer was able to land the more powerful blows that landed against Strickland, and it didn't matter how advancing Strickland was. If you have kicks and you have boxing like Cannoneer, you can beat a guy like Strickland, but Abusmagomedov doesn't strike like Jiří Cannoneer. Abusmagomedov doesn't strike like a Whittaker. He doesn't necessarily even strike like Hermanson, and that was a win for Strickland, and he sure as heck doesn't strike like Alex Pereira, because Magomedov doesn't stand and plant with his shots. But he also doesn't roll with head kicks at the same time. Now, I know he had that front kick against Dustin Stoicevic, but Magomedov is one of those guys that can mix a blend of traditional but unorthodox technique, and that's what's really gotten him to go. It's really been a cosmic gumbo for Abusmagomedov to get him to this point, and I know he had that shock left hook knockout against Lewis Taylor, the teammate of Bilal Muhammad, but out of these Magomedov wins, out of the losses, he's got that complete package. It's just not to the same kind of style as a Sean Strickland.
And I'll be curious to see how he does in a five-round atmosphere against a Strickland, who, yes, he doesn't always win those five-round fights, right? But his volume numbers are always at least above average. He's always doing something. And we've said this about Clay Guida for the longest time, right? Clay Guida, when he fights a prospect, what's the great thing that is going to be proven about that prospect? Whether or not they have good cardio. When you're fighting somebody like Sean Strickland, I do think cardio is that one thing that is going to be so important, but it's also how you're going to react to that pressure. We've seen some guys be able to hit him with their own power shots, Cannoneer being one to where, hey, both guys are high volume fighters, but Cannoneer is the X factor out of his power as well. I'm just really curious about this fight, because Magomedov has struggled in the past with just pressure fighters who get his back up against the cage, because he will plan and kind of brawl a little bit on the inside, and in those brawling moments, yes, he could clip Strickland with a big shot, but Strickland's got a pretty good chin. Like, we've seen him get hit by big shots at middleweight, and without the big weight cut down to 170, I do think he is a very durable fighter at this weight class. I just think it's a fun fight, because Strickland has all the tools he needs to win this fight, but he's going to have to follow a really important game plan to do. He's going to have to take this fight deeper into the waters, because I do think the kicks of Magomedov, at least early, the power on them, is going to give Strickland a little bit of issues.
And that's the thing for Sean Strickland. A lot of people have said, like, a death by a thousand cuts type of fighter, and he, obviously, you know, the fact that Chris Curtis going to be in the corner. This one's a hometown fight for them out of Vegas.
Remember that Jack Marshman fight?
They live next door. They're buds. But yeah, the Jack Marshman fight. But for me, the Christophe Jaco fight, where you're able to really cut him off, and even if you're following him at certain spots, Strickland was able to land the more damaging blows. Christophe Jaco over the PFL. Hey, yikes. Will Fleury. Yikes. Those two guys fought each other. The Uriah Hall fight, Uriah couldn't get it going. The Brennan Allen fight, it was just an accumulation. He really did a great job with that. And the Jack Hermanson thing fight, the same thing. But if you look at it for Strickland, the thing that can get him in trouble is he fights to a game plan and it can almost get him in the trouble. The Alex Pereira fight, why aren't you wrestling? Because he's not a wrestler. He's going to fight his game plan and stand in front of you, and he ate the power in that one. The Jiří Cannoneer fight, the same thing. The Zaleski fight, there was distance and separation for a spinning wheel kick.
So he's Joe Mazzulla. He can't make adjustments.
And the fight against Kamaru Usman, well, yeah, but no tears. And the fight against Kamaru Usman, it was the takedowns were the story. But
and that big overhand that dropped him.
Oh, boy. But if you look at it for these two guys, I mean, great strikers, but they do it in different ways. So this is one of those interesting fights. You look at it, you consider it numbers on a page, and this is the time out where what do? We throw it out to
the community section at YouTube,
and it's always out there, it's always before the fights. And the best part about doing it in the YouTube community tab is the fact that I've started to go and throw the pictures out there, and you get a ton of people that are throw their thoughts out there. So 1300 total votes in the last 12 hours on this one. 58% going with Sean Strickland. It was a really close 54% on our Instagram with Strickland. Out of the comments, Artem saying, in over 2 years, Magomedov has only spent 19 seconds inside a cage. Hard to tell you how good he really is, which makes the fight so hard to predict. JJ saying, never go against someone with the last name Medov. And the Sports Yellow saying, so scared for my favorite podcaster, assuming that his favorite podcaster is Sean Strickland. So, Matt, the fans ever so slightly going with Sean Strickland. Abusmagomedov, the boogeyman of the weekend.
It's a hard fight to predict because, again, you go back to the middleweight division, right? If this was bantamweight, if this was featherweight, like, unranked fighters couldn't fight Arnold Allen, right? Well, that's a difficult fight for most unranked fighters, but I do think Abusmagomedov has a great opportunity against Strickland.
Like, Ikram Aliskerov, in his third UFC fight, is going to fight Paulo Costa in a main event.
Exactly. Like, these are competitive fights, I think. Maybe that one might be tough, just because I do think Paulo... We'll talk about that fight later anyways. But I do think this fight is going to be a very close one. No matter what you think of both fighters, I just think stylistically, A, it'll make for a very fun fight, because Sean Strickland is going to bring the fight out of Magomedov. He has those great kicks up the middle, but if Strickland eliminates those, I I do think it is going to make him a much more limited fighter. And for that reason, I'm going to ever so slightly go with Sean Strickland. I do think the five-round atmosphere is going to be a big key, too. We bring up the fact that Magomedov, not only with the time off, his last fight wasn't very long either. Like, that's a really short time to go in there and have a 25-minute fight against a guy like Sean Strickland, who, has he won all of his main events? No, he hasn't, but he has been there and done that.
I mean, Sean Strickland off the couch on short notice, 20...
Yeah, true. No training.
Yeah, he had 204 against 194 Nastya Nemavov. He was able to push him back and negate some of those kicks out there. So, I do like Strickland in the matchup, but again, the main events for Strickland so far, Hall, Hermanson, Cannonier, Nemavov, 3-1 in those spots, the loss to Cannonier. And if you do look at it for a guy like Sean Strickland, I mean, the damage can accumulate if the numbers can get up there. So a big time fight in this one. Middleweight division is always in flux. Again, that Ali Skedov fight against Paulo Costa is coming up in the not so distant future. And then after this July 1st, this big time Canada Day card, then it's UFC 290, and you've got Volkanovski taking on Yair Rodriguez.
What a fight that is.
You've got a women's strawweight title fight as well, so a lot of things on the line at UFC 290, and this is just the road to get us there. You know it, we're going to be live for Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims here on YouTube, and sometimes that plays out quite well, and it did for both of us, two of us. Each of us switching one pick a piece, and it both worked out. Now, you hate to do that to cheapen the start of the week, but the reason why we do the show is because we get a chance to look at the weigh-ins.
Well, people miss weight, guys.
And look at how the week goes. So, a big-time show over there. You guys have been pumping it. You guys have been tossing the likes. The subscriptions are on the way. So, thank you so much for the engagement right there. And you're doing the darn thing listening to the audio podcast as well. So, give yourselves a pat on the back. You are going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.